listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, every other fifth Wednesday, which you are now hearing at a new time. I began the commentary of my last program by pointing out that hardly a day passes when there's not at least a single reference to Russian interference in the 2016 election and a warning about interference in this year's balloting. Since then, nothing has changed. Last Thursday, the New York Times went so far as to publish a special 12-page section with no advertising on Russia's, quote, plot to subvert an election, unraveling the Russia story thus far, unquote, illustrated with five full pages of dramatic photographic composites, the first of which on the front page has the head of Vladimir Putin morphing through what appears to be the heads of Paul Manafort, then through Michael Flynn, another character I couldn't recognize, into the stern face of Donald Trump. It would not be going too far to say the intent of the special report by New York Times reporters Scott Shane and Mark Mazzetti was to cast the U.S. president, witting or unwitting, as a Russian agent. Employing fact with fiction and supposition with omission, and a timeline indicating who was lying and who wasn't, the Times piece makes a convincing argument that something rotten had been going on between Moscow and the president and his associates, which the Mueller investigation is determined to reveal. There does seem to be enough evidence that Russians using phony Facebook, Instagram accounts did exploit the already existing divisions and tensions in the country over race, immigration, and the character of Hillary Clinton, but one might reasonably question whether their efforts were anywhere near as effective as similar racist and xenophobic comments that have been routinely aired for years on America's AM hate talk radio. A little later in the program, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking about another aspect of U.S.-Russian relations with an old friend and occasional guest on Takes on the World, Paris-based journalist Diana Johnstone. We'll be discussing a recent article of hers on Consortium News website entitled The Real Russian Interference in U.S. Politics. If Russia were trying to interfere in U.S. domestic politics, she argues, it wouldn't be attempting to change the U.S. system, but to prevent it from trying to change Russia's. The Cold War between the United States and Soviet Union was ostensibly a conflict between two ideologies and two socioeconomic systems, she points out. All that seems to be over. The day of new socialism dawned. The day of a new socialism may dawn unexpectedly, she writes, but today capitalism rules the world. At first glance, it may seem to be a classic clash between rival capitalists. And yet, once again, an ideological conflict is emerging, one which divides capitalists themselves, even in Russia and the United States itself. It is a conflict between American unipolar dominance and multipolar world. That's how Diana Johnstone begins her recent article on the U.S.-Russia conflict, and she'll expand on that when I speak with her at 20 minutes past the hour. So stay tuned for that. Aside from wishing that the New York Times had made a similar effort to examine the origins of the U.S. war in Iraq, of which it was a major booster, there was a serious omission in the special report that has come to characterize all mainstream reporting on the new Cold War with Russia. It is that there is no reference to the events that created the current standoff, namely the U.S. supported protest in Kiev's Maidan Square of the government of Ukraine's duly elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, which began at the end of November 2013. These protests made the news every day until February 2014, when the violence of right-wing protesters, some of whom have neo-Nazi connections, forced Yanukovych to flee for his life. What was curious was that after Yanukovych made an agreement with Germany and three other European countries to hold a special election and then stepped down peacefully, the level of violence escalated as if certain parties or countries did not want the protest to end peacefully. That the anti-Russian atmosphere among the protesters led Putin to fear that the Russians would be forced to abandon their naval base in the Crimean port city of Sebastopol, which, thanks to an agreement with the new Ukraine government following the collapse of the Soviet Union, had allowed the Russians to use the historic port on the Black Sea to station 25,000 troops there to protect it. Until 1954, when the Ukrainian-born Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev signed Crimea over to Ukraine, it had been part of Russia for close to 200 years, and its inhabitants, like most Eastern Ukrainians, identify more with Russia than with the West, and had not taken part in any anti-government demonstrations, a point our media never mentioned. So, following a referendum in which 97% of the voters reportedly backed rejoining Russia, and with the approval of the autonomous government of Crimea, Putin announced its annexation. I mentioned the sequence of events before and do it again now because the mainstream U.S. media, including NPR, has chosen to bury it. Moreover, unless you went looking for it online, only on this program have you heard Victoria Nuland, Obama's Deputy Secretary of State for Europe, and Hillary Clinton's former press spokeswoman, telling the Ukrainian American Association before the coup that the U.S. had already spent $5 billion in an effort to install a new regime in Ukraine. And only here are you likely to have heard a secretly recorded phone conversation of Nuland telling the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Jeff Pyatt, that her choice for Ukraine's next prime minister was Arseniy Yatsenyuk. And that's how it turned out. And how does the New York Times special report describe all this? Quote, after Russian troops seized Crimea and carried out a stealth invasion of Ukraine in 2014, relations with the U.S. grew openly hostile. American support for the new government in Kiev and condemnation of Russian behavior heightened Mr. Putin's rage at being told what he could do and could not do in what he considers his own backyard, end quote. First, there was no Russian invasion, stealth or otherwise, of Ukraine. Had there been, Russian troops would have made short work of Ukrainian forces. What Moscow did was provide weapons and logistical support to the Russian-speaking eastern Ukrainians who felt historic ties to Russia on their border and who resented the fact that the Ukrainians in the West, led by the political descendants of the Nazi sympathizers who their relatives had fought in the Second World War, had overthrown the president whom they had voted for. That angle evidently was not something the Western media was interested in exploring. The annexation of Crimea provided Washington with an excuse to apply sanctions on Russia as well as to pump new life into NATO. America had a new bogeyman and a new Cold War, and beginning with Obama, the justification to pressure Washington's NATO partners to cut their spending on the public's welfare and step up their purchases of weapons of war, a large proportion, no doubt, coming from the U.S. arms industry. Lacking America's military might, the Times reporter suggests that, quote, by making mischief in the 2016 election, Mr. Putin could wreak revenge on his enemy, Mrs. Clinton, the presumed Democratic nominee, damaging if not defeating her. Clinton, it should be recalled, compared Putin with Hitler after the annexation of Crimea and then campaigned on the promise of standing up to him if elected. She had earlier incurred his wrath by declaring that his party's victory in the 2011 election of the Duma was flawed in praising those Russians who had been in the streets of Moscow protesting the results. This is the same Clinton whose supporters in the Democratic National Committee, we learn from WikiLeaks, sabotaged the candidacy of her presidential rival Bernie Sanders. Clearly, there was every reason for Putin to prefer Trump. Speaking of Clinton brings to mind the hottest story of these past days, the alleged violent sexual acts committed against two young women 3 decades ago by Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, and a critical fact about the 2016 election, that the majority of white women, 54%, voted for Donald Trump, a known sexual predator for president. Why they did so might have had to do with Clinton's past. When Hillary's husband, former President Bill Clinton, was publicly accused by 14 women of raping or molesting them going back to the time when he was Attorney General of Arkansas, Hillary stood by her man and attacked his victims as liars. However, when the Access Hollywood tape was released depicting Trump boasting of how he groped women by the genitals whenever he felt like doing so, and Clinton sharply criticized him for his attitudes and history toward women, those with long memories quite likely viewed her as a hypocrite. Outside of 10 Downing Street and the headquarters of NATO, the preoccupation with Russia and Putin is largely an American phenomenon. There is one internationally recognized individual, however, who has called for the demonization of Russia to end. It is the Irish former Nobel Prize laureate, Mairead McGuire, who said Russia is not by any means without fault. But the amount of anti-Russian propaganda in our media today is a throwback to the Cold War era. We must ask the question, is this leading to more arms, to a bigger NATO? Possibly, she says, to challenge large powers in the Middle East and Asia, as we see in the U.S. approaching the South China Sea and NATO naval games taking place in the Black Sea. Missile compounds, she writes, are being erected in Romania, Poland, and other ex-Soviet countries, while military games are set up in Scandinavia, close to the Russian border, to practice for a cold climate war scenario. The demonization of Russia is, I believe, one of the most dangerous things that is happening in our world today, writes Marilyn McGuire. The scapegoating of Russia is an inexcusable game that the West is indulging in. It is time for political leaders and each individual to move us back from the brink of catastrophe to begin relationships with our Russian brothers and sisters. Too long has the elite financially gained from war while millions are moved into poverty and desperation. The people of the world have been subjected to war propaganda based on lies and misinformation, and we have seen the results of invasions and occupations by NATO disguised as humanitarian intervention and right to protect. NATO has destroyed the lives of millions of people and purposely devastated their lands, causing the exodus of millions of refugees. The people around the world must not be misled again. That's an excerpt from an article, Demonization of Russia in a New Cold War Era, A Plea for Sanity by Marilyn McGuire, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1976 for her actions that helped end the deep ethnic and political conflict in her native Northern Ireland. Well, President Trump made his second speech to the U.N. General Assembly yesterday and got his audience laughing at the start when he bragged about the extraordinary progress we've made. In less than 2 years, he told the world leaders, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. As he began his next boast, some of the hall erupted with laughter, leading a seemingly surprised Trump to respond. Well, didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay. Trump's comments on other subjects were predictable and did not draw laughs, but the most ominous were his remarks on Iran, which Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu can be expected to double down on when he speaks to the General Assembly tomorrow. Repeating the Israeli fable that Iran is, quote, the leading state sponsor of terrorism, Trump claimed that his leaders sow chaos, death, and destruction, accusing them of not respecting their neighbors or borders or the sovereign rights of nations, an extraordinary claim coming from the lips of an American president. He went on to describe the campaign of economic pressure to deny the regime the funds it needs to advance its bloody agenda. Well, and yesterday, at another forum in New York, Trump's bellicose national security advisor, John Bolton, promised, quote, terrible consequences for anyone who continues to do business with Iran after November 4th. Today, the United States will reinstate the remaining sanctions if it had lifted under the nuclear deal. We do not intend to allow our sanctions to be evaded by Europe or anybody else, he said. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, speaking at the same forum, said the Trump administration was, quote, disturbed and deeply disappointed, end quote, by plans announced Monday night by Britain, France, Germany, and other countries committed to the Iran nuclear accord to create an unspecified economic channel that would be protected from American sanctions. This is one of the most counterproductive measures imaginable for regional and global peace and security, Pompeo said. By sustaining revenues to the regime, you are solidifying Iran's ranking as the number one state sponsor of terror. What else? Unquote. In essence, the U.S. bully has declared an attack on Iran even more severe than what preceded the invasion of Iraq, while working secretly with Israel, the Saudis, United Arab Emirates to undermine the regime from within. Trump will be meeting today with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who will address the General Assembly tomorrow. Netanyahu was in the air on his way to the U.S. at the time of Trump's speech, but other Israeli politicians warmly welcomed his words. Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman said, quote, at the club of hypocrites and fakers called the United Nations, we heard today an impressive speech by U.S. President Donald Trump. It has been years since the world stage has seen a leader who understands the Middle East, addresses the Iranian threat, and sets red lines for Syrian President Assad, said Lieberman. I hope world leaders will listen and internalize his words, end quote. Construction and Housing Minister Yoav Gallant said, Trump, you are a friend. Israel knows who to deal with its enemies. It's good to know, however, that there are those who really stand by us. The U.S. has proven once again, he said, that we have someone we can trust in the White House, which is the most important place after Jerusalem. Russian President Putin and Netanyahu are as close as any two leaders on the world stage, with Netanyahu having made 7 state visits to Moscow over the past few years. There's tension today, however, between the two countries, following the shooting down by Syrian anti-aircraft of a Russian reconnaissance plane, killing the 15-man crew, which the Russian military has blamed on Israel. It seems the shooting was arranged by Israeli F-16s who were caught on Syrian radar and then hid behind the much larger Ilyushin 20, fooling the Syrian S-200 missile crew on the ground. Israel military, which sent a delegation of senior Air Force officials to Moscow to present the results of its investigation of the incident, denied using the IL-20 as cover, but General Konashev insisted that, quote, today's data no longer suggests but clearly proves the blame for the tragedy with the Russian IL-20 aircraft lies entirely with the Israeli Air Force and with those who authorize this kind of activity. This has proved embarrassing for Putin, who initially tried to explain the incident by describing it as caused by a chain of tragic coincidences. That statement evidently did not go down well with the Russian military.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine. طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح
طفلة. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. By now, we have all heard reports that the United States is continuing its assault on the Palestinian people by cutting off all aid to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. What does this mean for the Palestinian people, especially those trapped in Gaza? We addressed that this morning in a presentation by Mohammed Eid, who was born and grew up in a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip and who has been working for UNRWA in Gaza. Mohammed Eid gave this PowerPoint presentation in the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, as a radio audience, you will not see the images he occasionally refers to, but the power of his narrative is the core of the presentation and makes it relevant for our purposes. It begins with an introduction by Mohammed Mohammed, Director of the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C.
My name is Mohammed Mohammed. I'm the executive director here at the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center. On behalf of our board of directors and our staff, it's a pleasure, as always, to have you here. And thank you also for everybody that is watching online. It's also a great honor to introduce our distinguished speaker today, Mohammed Eid, who's right here. And he will be speaking today about UNRWA's role and impact in the Gaza Strip, specifically coming from his perspective as a refugee. Mohammed is a 28-year-old Palestine refugee who's currently a Rotary Peace Scholar pursuing a master's degree in global studies and international development. Through a joint program at the University of North Carolina and Duke University. During this talk, Mohammed will share his story about growing up in Gaza and the role the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, which is also known as UNRWA, the role that they played in his life. And just to give a little bit of a background about Mohammed, he is from the Gaza Strip, which is one of the most one of the worst conflict zones in the world, yet is also a very beautiful and lovely place. After studying applied linguistics at the University of Southampton in England, Muhammad began working for the United for UNRWA in 2011 as a youth education specialist. He has worked on many programs and initiatives related to education development and youth empowerment. During the conflict of 2012, Muhammad also worked in the centers that hosted and provided aid to refugees. In the following years, following 4 years, his country was subject to two fierce wars in which there were unprecedented levels of crisis and a rapid deterioration of the humanitarian situation. When Muhammad applied for the Rotary Peace Fellowship, he saw it as a chance to earn significant skills and knowledge, specifically within the Department of Global Studies. He hopes this knowledge will help him coordinate with the United Nations Development Program, the UNDP, and other NGOs in an attempt to reform the humanitarian relief program and present a new system that is capable of functioning during a large-scale crisis. He hopes this will contribute to ending the violence and reaching a lasting solution that will save thousands of lives. Muhammad will speak for 30 to 40 minutes, after which we'll have our Q&A session. Without further ado, please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Muhammad Eid.
Thank you, Muhammad. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to start by thanking you for dedicating your time, and I will thank everyone who's watching us online. I would like to start, for those of you who are not very aware of the geographical context of Palestine. So this map shows the what we would like to call it Israel-Palestine, if you may, and the territory that is marked with this light color is Israel, and the territory that is marked with the darker color is Palestine. You can see that Palestine is two parts, and it's geographically separated. One part that's called West Bank and Eastern Jerusalem, and one part that is called Gaza Strip. So if we zoom in to Gaza Strip, this is Gaza Strip, and it's 8 refugee camps, as categorized by the UN. On the eastern and northern borders, it's a buffer zone, and this is Israeli borders. It's 1 kilometer, or during the rise of conflict, it goes to be up to 3 kilometers buffer zone. After the conflict or after the assault, it's 1 kilometer buffer zone, no man's zone. I come from Rafah refugee camp. It's in the far south, lies by the Egyptian border and the Israeli borders as well. This is one of the only photos I have in the refugee camp. We didn't have the privilege of having cameras or cell phone, smart cell phones back then. This is my home, what I would like to call home. This is the place where I grew up and spent all of my life as a refugee. You can see it's randomly built. It's covered with corrugated metal, freezing cold in winter, scorching hot in summer. The streets are very narrow, but we liked it. We lived there. We just enjoyed being in that refugee camp. We built a special social relationship with our neighbors. Those are the streets of the refugee camp. They're very narrow. It's the place where we study, play, sometimes eat, and in summer sleep, because the houses will be really hot, especially with the power cut. One of the happy memories I had when I was a child was going with my father for taking or receiving the food package from the UNRWA center. The food package will be delivered once a month or sometimes once each other month. Depends on how much the UNRWA receives fund from the donors. The food package would include oil, lentils, chickpeas, some basics. But the most basics food supply. But the most important and significant thing for us was the flour. The Palestinian people who grow up eating bread. We eat bread all the time. Flour allows families to bake. We wake up and baking normally, Palestinian families, they start baking first thing in the morning. So as a child, I would wake up on the smell of bread, and my mom would be baking within the house, and there's even local poetry about the smell of the bread in the Palestinian house. Mahmoud Darwish wrote one of those poems of poets. We dip bread in tea. That's our favorite meal. We have it on breakfast, on lunch, and on dinner. We don't have the three meals in one day. In my life, where I lived in the refugee camp, I had the privilege of walking every day to the school, or I would walk every day to the school, but on Saturday, we would have a local market. It's called Saturday Market. And in different regions, there is different markets depending on the day, on different days throughout the week. So on Saturday, which was a school day, it was a weekday. In the Middle East, the weekend is a Friday, and most of the organizations will operate on Saturday. So I would walk to school, and I would do that through the market, through the local market, and I would meet the locals, old ladies, old men, young people. They're just sitting there randomly. There is no laws, no regulations. Everyone is just have to be considerate for the person next to him. It is very nice. I know some of them. Some of them knows my family. I chat with them as I pass by. Those old ladies, I know most of them. I would just be saying, hi, how is your son doing? She might be asking me about my family or my siblings. Sometimes I pass by, I hear someone trying to bargain the prices with them, and they get the harshest comeback from those ladies. I learned that was a bad idea at a very young age. So in Palestine, if you grab up a camera, immediately children around you will start smiling. They just detect it, and they like to be recorded. We used to call every man an uncle and every woman aunt. And every grown-up would call every child son or daughter. So I would feel like everyone is my family, every place is my home. Literally, I could ask anyone for water if I go thirsty as I'm walking. You could walk into any house. And I remember I would be walking into school on Saturday during the market day, and I would be distracted by everything around me. And many people would be coming down to me and saying, son, you're getting late to school. And I was like, okay, yeah, better rush. This is one of the photos for the busy downtown areas. Maybe the photo doesn't show that, but the cars are moving. The people are moving at the same time. And there's a policeman who's doing his job. It looks random. It looks complicated. It looks unorganized, but it's not. There is a very organizing system over there, and everyone knows that. So the idea is that when people walk by cars or between cars, if they want to cross, if they want to cross in front of the car, or if the car is reversing and they want to cross, all they have to do is just to tap on the body of the car. And somehow it works. The sound is magnified. The driver will hear it inside very loud. Do it to a friend. I'll see you'll freak him out. So immediately as the driver hears that sound, he stops. And the passenger or the pedestrian will pass by. Sometimes you're walking by and someone is reversing, and he's reversing into a very tiny space. So we just stop and give him directions. And then we move on. It's just... The main rule here is that be considerate for people around you and for everyone around you, and then things can move on. I loved going outside to buy the falafel from the falafel shacks. It's kind of the simplest family business people do in Gaza Strip. If you ever see a falafel shack in Palestine, you will see that there is no line for the falafel shacks. Simply because the culture there says that it's inappropriate to give your back to someone. And people have very strong social relationships that they chat with each other all the time. So if they stand by the falafel shack, they will actually stand next to each other. And that's how you get to chat to the people on both sides. But you don't give your back to anyone. So if women and children show up, they will be given priority. But... otherwise, they will be like a small crowd, and they're all buying falafel and just giving the opportunity for anyone to move on. There's no fight for the line. This is the basic rule for the falafel queue. When it rains in Gaza Strip, that would be a party for young children. We would go out in the rain, dance, have fun. If it keeps raining, then the party stops because the water rises, gets into the houses. And then we have to leave. We take our stuff, whatever is still dry, and we leave the houses. We go to the honorable schools. Because in Gaza Strip, we don't have hotels, we don't have emergency centers, and we figured out a long time ago that schools are basically classrooms. It's very similar to the structure of hotels, and we can use them during emergency. So we go to schools, and the UNRWA would provide people with aid and emergency response in such crisis. Sometimes we sail to schools. It would be like a trip. This is one of the families that has been hosted recently in the UNRWA schools during a storm. Not the perfect place, not the perfect conditions, but much better than if they would stay in their flooded houses. Speaking about schools, this is a picture, a photo of an old school. This is exactly what my school looked like when I was young. We had one floor buildings. My school had lots of trees around them because the classrooms are covered by corrugated metal and it goes really hot in summer. So the trees would be covering the classrooms. The classrooms were amazing. This is not a swimming pool, this is a playground, but it has just rained. Classrooms would have, on the lower levels, it would have from 50 to 60 students. At the upper level, it would have some between 40 to 50 students. It's very, very crowded, very noisy sometimes, but it's just amazing. I would say this is the best education I have received in my life. This is the nicest things that have happened to me. I wouldn't say enough about my teachers. The teachers were teachers, they were parents, they were mental counselors, they were caretakers. They did much more than they were expected to do. They knew my family, they knew the family of everyone. Sometimes you call them teachers, sometimes you call them uncles, sometimes we call them Abu Ahmad, for example. It means the father of your elder son. That's how Arabs call each other. It's a kind of being close to them, being very friendly with each other. We would do our homework in the courtyard, on the stairs, on the floor, anywhere. Every place could be our studying desk. Schools have changed in Palestine now. This is a very recent school for the UNRWA schools in Gaza Strip. And you can see it's multi-floor building. The students are having tournaments, some sort of tournament or festival. It's amazing. The UNRWA also have an in-service training program where they keep training staff all the time and improving their abilities and skills. So you can see here students, they're learning using games and toys. It's very new and smart methods. We didn't have that privilege back then, but I wouldn't complain. I enjoyed my own way of learning or my teacher's way of teaching. So I remember the first time I lived through a military operation, and that was when I was 14 year old. I woke up at night on the sound of the tank's engine. And tanks are so huge. They have huge engine. You could hear it from a mile or more even. So we woke up on that sound, and there was bombing, there was shooting. We figured out it wouldn't be smart to walk outside until we figure out what is happening. So we stayed inside. And when you're staying inside and the shooting and the bombing is happening outside, you basically think that it's all around you, it's all targeted on you, and because you're still alive, you have the idea or the conception that I'm the only survivor in this village so far. Because the sound is so scary, the whole house is shaking, that you figure out everyone has gone. So we stayed inside all the night. In the morning, we heard someone who was shouting at us, and he said, everyone has to leave the house. He was someone from our camp. As the tanks proceeded through the village, they were followed by bulldozers. And then because the camp is very narrow. There are no, the streets, the roads do not even fit for cars. They wouldn't fit for bulldozers, of course. So they created roads as they driven through. They driven through houses, creating their own roads. When we heard that person asking for everyone to leave, we walked outside. I stood in front of my house, and I looked at the end of the road, and I could see the bulldozer proceeding through the road and knocking down houses on both sides. And maybe the photo doesn't show that, but the bulldozer is a huge vehicle. I would describe it as a two-story building. And when I was a child, and I would look up to such huge creature or spaceship, that was very scary. We left houses. Here you see a family. All of them are trying to signal to the soldier or the driver, telling him, wait, this is in our culture in the Middle East. If you signal that way and shake your hand to someone, it means wait. Because some people were still inside. They couldn't leave on time in the house. And he started bringing down the house. So people would leave, and that would be the worst scene. My family have always told us how they left from the north and came to the south, to Gaza Strip, and became refugees. We've always heard stories about it, but then suddenly we were reliving the same crisis that they have been through. We would take everything we can with us, not because it's worthy, but because we want to feel that that we have saved something, especially if we're going to sleep in the streets the following few nights, then we could use a few mattresses and blankets. The very next day, immediately as the military operation stops, the first thing we would see would be the UN vehicles. It doesn't matter if it was working hours or not working hours, they're always on duty. They will come immediately as the military operation stops, and they will provide us with the most important things needed. Mainly, they will start with the drinking water, because we have lost all the drinking, all the water supplies. It has all been destroyed. Normally, the first thing that will be destroyed, the drinking supplies and the power supplies. And then the next thing they would offer us, they would provide us with tents. Sometimes those tents would be put in schools, they would be put in other places away from the border area. But for most of the families, we would prefer to have our tents right next to the buildings or to the houses that were destroyed. And for a reason, when I think about it, that helps people deal with their trauma. My family stayed in that tent for months after our house was destroyed. And that was just to think about it, just to accept our loss, to feel comfortable walking away after that, and then we move away. So in that tent, I went to sleep. We lived, we ate, we chatted with each other. We studied. I would go to school from that tent and go back to home, calling this tent home. Think of it as a long time camping. I grew up and I started working for the UNRWA. And talking about the UNRWA, I would like to mention that I won't be speaking on behalf of anyone other than myself, Muhammad, the refugee from the refugee camp. I grew up, I studied in a local college, and I started working for the UNRWA, the education department. The UNRWA has seven programs. Three of them are the main and the biggest programs: the education, the relief and social service, the health program. The education serves over 500,000 refugee children. The health program serves over 9 million patients, 9 million patients each year. And the other programs, the protection, the microfinance, the infrastructure and camp improvement, the emergency response are all small programs trying to help as much as possible. I worked for the education department, and I managed to work with young people. I managed to work with teachers and help them develop the curriculum, help them improve their teaching strategies, evaluate, assess the whole process. That was something I really enjoyed and I liked doing, and I wish that I could do for the rest of my life, until the budget, some of the fund was transferred to the emergency response program, and then some of the staff were transferred to the emergency response program. That included me in 2012 and in 2014, military assault. So we in 2012 we learned lessons from the military assault, and we prepared for the next one. We had a plan, and we thought that next time we'll be more prepared, and we will be able to host up to 50,000 refugees. We'll perfectly host them, provide them with the services, all the services and emergency response, and that should be good. So if you see the time difference, the bombing started at 4 and finished at 5. In 1 hour, the whole village was destroyed and everyone was displaced, the ones who survived. In the first 3 days or 4 days of the conflict, the UNRWA had 50,000 refugees on the shelters that we have prepared. We wished that the war would, the conflict would only last for 5 days maybe. Unfortunately, it lasted for 51 days. By the end of that attack, the UNRWA had 300,000 refugees on site, 6 times more than we have expected and more than we have prepared to receive. The crisis was definitely overwhelming. What happens is that once the bombing starts, the refugees immediately, or the people, the civilians immediately leave their houses and head to the UNRWA schools. People will be marching down the streets in huge numbers. That would be scary. It's like nothing would be like that. People would go into the UNRWA schools, whether they're open or not. Sometimes they would open the schools and get inside. It's war. People will be dying in that case. And then what happens, the UNRWA staff gets there. They prepare the place for them. They give the approval to open the place as a refugee shelter or not. Once it's approved, they will get everyone inside. This is one of the classrooms. Chairs has been taken outside, and then you can see that families, it's very crowded. Families are sitting there, children, women. It's amazing when you walk inside, you grab a camera and you want to take a photo, and then you see children start smiling to you. They are the hope in that misery. And you can see that there are no men in those refugee shelters or in those classes. And that's because of that conservative culture. Out of consideration, men will actually stay outside, or they will stay even in the streets. So if you go outside, we see all the men. They're hanging out, giving all the space for women and children. They also sleep outside. We've provided them with rooms only for men to go and sleep inside, but then they gave those rooms to children and women to give them extra space, and they insisted on sleeping outside. The UNRWA provides them with a very important aid and services they need. The first thing we start with would be the mattresses. And you can see that they have different colors, different size, different shapes, because we don't have large suppliers in Gaza Strip. We basically buy them on individual basics. We call people, we call the suppliers, and someone would be able to provide us with 5 mattresses. Someone would even provide us with 1 mattress, and we just collect them on that way. The good thing about doing that is that we always try to support the local community. So kind of support the economy of the local community, the hosting society. But it's definitely sometimes we fall short in certain situations. Also, water is one of the most important supplies. During the last military assault in 2014, the 1 gallon of drinking water reached the price of $100, and we couldn't even find it. So when the UN staff reported the humanitarian needs, they asked for drinking water. And then the higher administration wasn't so happy with that. They said, we can't just pay all that money for transferring all that supplies, and then eventually it's just water. This has to be provided locally, and we will have to bring other important things from outside. Then the emergency people, the emergency reporting staff, they said, this is the only thing we need right now as emergency appeal. It's only drinking water. And we ended up getting drinking water from Jordan, and convoys of drinking water brought all the water from Jordan to Gaza Strip, because we didn't have them locally. The UNRWA would provide, having refugees, having people who have just lost their houses, have just lost their family members, they're sitting in there, and Gaza Strip is a very small place. So when there is bombing, we're actually sitting there and we're hearing it happening around us. So having people in there for 51 days, it's a very stressful, very traumatizing experience. So people, the UNRWA would mobilize mental counselors who would come and provide children with games, with exercises, with debriefing sessions, rehabilitation programs, in a way of helping those young people and the senior people as well, and kind of overcoming their traumas. Unfortunately, the UNRWA staff, they get themselves traumatized sometimes, and they fall victims of the situations. So in 2014, more than around 23 UNRWA staff were killed on duty. At some point, the refugee shelters, the schools themselves, were bombed, and people were killed inside. This is one of the schools or the refugee shelters where I used to live. It's in Rafah camp, and you can see it says Rafah Prep Boys School. It's a school, but it has been opened as a refugee camp. It has been bombed during the war. It's very far from the border area. It has been categorized as a safe zone. Suddenly, with all that crowded places, the crowded rooms, the crowded playground where men would stay outside, as I showed you in the photo, suddenly bombs were dropped over their heads. We told them 33 times where exactly the refugee shelters were. So every morning, the first thing we do in the morning is that we send reports with coordinations saying so-and-so place is being dedicated as a refugee shelter. And we have to repeat that on a daily basis. So by that day, they have been reported 33 times that this place was a refugee shelter. And it was bombed. It was a surprise for everyone. We didn't know what to do. We didn't know what else we can do. Personally speaking, protection is a relative thing. After all, people did not leave that refugee shelter. People stayed there because they knew that protection was a relative thing. Even with that bombing, still those shelters were the most safe place possible. I'm going to talk about the challenges and difficulties we faced in that context, or working in that context. And among that was the carpet bombing. The carpet bombing is so, or basically some other people would call it random bombing, which is just bomb an area. There is another term for it. They call it scorched land policy, where they just bomb everything that is moving, everything that is over the ground, a building, a house, a car, anything. In that area, that's in eastern Rafah. That is the Rafah Black Friday. If you search that in Google, you will get all the information. In two to three hours, 300 or 200 people were killed in Rafah Black Friday. Bodies, injured people were all over the streets, all over the roads. Calls were coming from everywhere, and the response was way below the scale of the crisis. There was an UNRWA refugee shelter in that area during the carpet bombing, and people were evacuated just a few minutes before bombs targeted that school. And you can see here that the bombing is mainly centered around the main road. So mobility is really... It becomes very difficult, very challenging, and the thing people have to do is just walk. They walk from house to house, from a farm to farm, through the side roads, and it becomes very challenging. Also, one of the main challenges was bombing the power station, which is one of the most strategic targets. That probably that would be the target of the first day of the military assault. The first thing we have to deal with is the bombing of the power station. So we have to know that we will lose the running water, we will lose the sewage treatment, and everything that works on electricity. Something else was the surprise of the white phosphorus, or the which is categorized as illegal weapon according to Geneva Accord. It's bombed, and it covers the whole, one bomb can cover the whole neighborhood. It's a white material that burns for days. It burns literally for days, and it produces a very stinging gas, very acidic gas that is hard to breathe, and it stings the skin itself. The skin would feel burning just being in that region. That substance, if it hits the human flesh, then it's, as locals call it, it's a flesh-eating weapon. It just goes through the flesh. It's so scary, so crazy. We tried pouring water on that, and the more we pour water, the bigger it goes. It's like we're feeding it. The other challenge or problem we faced was bombing Rafah Hospital, which is the only hospital in Rafah. It was bombed. And the Ministry of Health, the health staff had to evacuate everyone. They had to evacuate the dead bodies. And the conflict happened in July. That was the attack. You could imagine having no electricity and having lots of dead bodies. We haven't recognized to whom they belong or haven't recognized their families, and it's in July. That was a very critical situation. One of the solutions the UNRWA came up with was giving one of their main generators to a local farm storage or vegetable storage. It was like a huge storage that is used to freeze vegetables. And then they got all the vegetables outside and they put all the bodies inside that fridge for those days. And the UNRWA helped the local Ministry of Health and the local health department in developing a categorization program or plan to identify the families, and to identify the bodies and find the families in a very quick way, to arrange funerals, because the numbers were huge and we couldn't wait. We thought that would last forever. One of the other challenges would be the problems with the staff. The staff has families. They live in that conflict zones, in those targeted areas. They will get affected. They will feel bad for their families. I myself received a call when I was in one of the refugee shelters saying that my neighborhood is being under military operation, and my father told me to come back home immediately because we need to get everyone outside. We need to get out a few things. I went back home, and I couldn't find home. I just looked everywhere, and I couldn't recognize the whole area. It just evaporated. This crater is what you see after a house is being bombed. And because the place is too crowded, the houses are too narrow, then this house is being bombed, but this house is completely destroyed, as well as this one. And those ones are partially destroyed, and this one is completely destroyed. So you basically, one bomb could destroy a whole neighborhood. I went back there immediately. I found my house was bombed. I looked for everyone. Once I found out that no one was killed in there, once I found out that all of my family has left on time, I didn't care. I didn't mind. Once you experience the feeling of losing someone you know or someone you love, everything else becomes easy for you to accept. You will never complain about things. 10 minutes after I was there, I saw my family, I saw my father, and then we were having fun and telling jokes about the bombing and about losing the house and about the bad decor and about structure, and maybe we could avoid making the same mistakes this time. Those are two different photos, of course, but just I wanted to show you how it would look like from above. Leaving Gaza Strip and coming for this course, for this program that I'm doing right now, during one of the training sessions the UNRWA have held for the staff, I was one of the training, the international trainers. He suggested to me that there is an fellowship, American fellowship, that teaches students in the fields of conflict, peace, and humanitarian aid. And he said, just make an application and maybe it will work out for you. I did an application and I was selected for the Rotary Fellowship to come to University of North Carolina and Duke, study global studies and international development. That was very interesting, very exciting, only if I could leave Gaza Strip, because no one is allowed to leave Gaza Strip. I mean, that's what it means to have a siege. The UNRWA thought that this program will contribute to their operation, so they agreed on applying on my behalf for a travel permit. They did that, and I was informed 7 times that I'm allowed to travel. And I would pack my stuff, say goodbye to my family, go to the buffer zone, spend the whole day, go through the security interrogation, and then by the end of the day, they will ask me to go back. On the 8th time, I was told that this is the last time. Like every time they would say, come to the buffer zone, and we have given you a conditional offer, which is going through the security interrogation, which is something we're used to. I went there, and I saw that they have already bombed, this is on the Palestinian side, they have already bombed the crossing point authority. So we basically land into a place that is very traumatizing, very scary. There's no man in there. And I found someone who acts like he's selling tea, but I feel like he's part of the staff. So I asked him, and he said, yes, I'm part of the staff. You just walk in there, and you shout out. You whistle, and someone will come out and help you. I was like, okay. So I walked in. I shouted for people, and someone came out, and he said, you're leaving, or what are you asking for? I said, yes, I'm leaving. And he said, follow me. He took me, and basically they will be hiding next to a wall, under a tree, finding a close home and staying inside. They will just keep changing their position because they're very scared that at some point the drones will come up in the sky and they will bomb them. And that happens all the time. So they stamped my passport and they sent me to the next point where there was security people, security team, who reached out to the Israeli side and they said, we have this and that person. This is his name. This is his ID number. Let us know when should we let him in. After a while, they reached out to them on the radio and they said, let Muhammad Eid come in. The security team, they were very nice. They told me they have this door or this gate built on the Palestinian side. They say to you, if your bag fits in that rolling door, then take it with you. If it doesn't, then leave it behind because the Israeli army will not allow you to take it in. My bag did fit that door, luckily. I went inside, and then I have to walk through the buffer zone for 1 kilometer. That's 1,000 meters, maybe 3,000 feet. Walking in there, just dragging my back, and it's no man's zone. Everything around me is destroyed. No trees, no houses, no buildings, no one, nothing. This is the buffer zone that connects Gaza Strip to the wall. The wall is a huge 30-foot wall with military towers across the wall. And once I get close to the wall, that's where I would find the gates. The most scary thing about the wall wasn't the military towers, but it was the mobility or the movement sensation or sensitive machine guns. So I would be walking in there. They tell me that if you walk inside this tunnel, the machine guns will not sense your movement and they will not kick in and start shooting at you. So I would be walking there, hopefully that it does not do that. Once I reach that end, I'll find the gates, 2 gates. They watch me through the camera. I have to open my bag, empty everything, and they watch it through the camera, then bring everything back inside. Once they get sure that I've shown everything, they open the gate. I walk inside. There is a table inside. So I do the same thing again. I empty my bag on that table, and the table has some kind of a scanner system. It scans everything. I take everything inside again and walk in. I reached the Israeli side. This is the Israeli Air is crossing. You want to travel, and by the crossing you see a tank and soldiers with heavy machine guns. Every person who works at that crossing is either a soldier or a special force soldier or something like that. And it's a very scary place to travel through. When I reached there, at the other side, they simply, I went through the security interrogation and all the procedures, but then suddenly they said to me, they brought a small bag, like a bag you would take to the gym, or you would have your meal in that bag when you go to work. And they said to me, fill this bag with clothes and leave everything behind. Your cell phone, your laptop, your food, your drink, your electronics, everything, not even my flash drive. And I said to them, I can't do that. I have to have my laptop on me. I'm a student. I'm traveling to study. I have to have my laptop on me. And they said, well, that's fine. You can have everything on you, but make sure you go back to Gaza Strip and tell everyone that we allowed you to travel and you are the one who said no. Yeah. So I kind of figured out that it was their way of dealing with my request to travel. The UNRWA has asked for that. The U.S. consulate was involved in that process. The Rotary Foundation was involved in that process. So probably too many people have gave them a headache, so they decided to kind of play a game with that. I left everything behind and took their bag and left. The way it works, I leave from the north of Gaza Strip, and then I take a taxi. I pay for it. It's a very expensive taxi. No one would like to work in that region, unless if he was desperate. I would take a taxi, and then would be accompanied by an army vehicle. I will drive, go all the way through the Israeli territory, and then the Palestinian territory, and then I go to Jericho. In Jericho, I have to pass the more than three checkpoints. It would be Israeli checkpoints, would be Palestinian checkpoints, and Jordanian checkpoints. Once I'm cleared by the three checkpoints, and for the Israelis, they would have more than one checkpoint, and they would be the worst checkpoints. They have very strict regulations. And they're separated from the checkpoint in Gaza Strip. They don't coordinate with each other. So I have to go through the same process all over again. Once I finish, I pass to Jordan. I stayed in Jordan for 10 days, 2 weeks. I finished my visa, the U.S. visa interview. I wanted to do that in the West Bank or in Tel Aviv. I said to them, I just have to quickly do the U.S. visa interview and then travel to Jordan. And they said, no. Not Arabs from Gaza Strip are not allowed to go into Israel. They didn't even use other terms. They said it that clear and that loud. So I went to Jordan. I done that in Jordan. And then after that, I traveled to the U.S. Since I came here, I haven't met, I haven't seen, but very generous community, very generous and kind and friendly people. People have been very supportive for me. They have been very kindly responding to me and to my people and to my community. I have nothing but to thank everyone, to thank my host community, my friends in North Carolina, my neighbors, the UNRWA USA I'm volunteering with right now. Everyone I have met so far has been so friendly to me. I can't but appreciate that. And I cannot ignore the fact that the American people have stood by my people during the past 70 years of their suffering. I thank you very much for your listening, and I would like to take your questions. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Mohammed Eid speaking at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., about life in Gaza and especially the role played by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which he worked for several years.
So I believe it's a great fallacy to set out to brand those whom we disagree with as being evil people. The result of their actions, we may perceive to be evil. We may perceive it to be bad. But I guarantee you, those people don't see it that way. And when we present ourselves to them in that light, we're good and they're evil, do you think we have a chance of getting them to listen to us? Not on your life.
Back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Russian GRU loitering around in The Hague, trying to undermine the investigation into Novichok. Also, apparently, Russian cyber attacks swirling around the world in many different countries. Canada, the UK, the Netherlands, Switzerland, Malaysia, Brazil, and the USA. discussed the Batan Kali massacre of the 24 Malay insurgency suspects by the Scots Guards in 1948 is ruled out of time by the European Court of Human Rights. It's been compared to the My Lai massacre in 1968 by the United States forces in Vietnam. But let's get Batan Kali in perspective. My Lai villagers, 500 of them, were executed by American soldiers. And what about Mao's unspeakable Great Chinese Famine of 1958 to 1961, which I've only just found out about? Wonder if you've heard of it. Around 25 million Chinese starved to death. Tonight we hear from former SAS officer Barry Wynn, who fought in Malaysia, all about jungle warfare and also his testimony he gave in defence of the families of those who lost their lives in Batan Kali as Britain was fighting a losing battle after World War II to keep the empire. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Mass media have turned a blind eye to. There's plenty of them. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at Tuesday at noon. You can download it online now, though, at dialectradio.co.uk. This week we travel to Arnhem. Well, I travelled to Arnhem and some of the interviews I did over there to hear direct from the museum at the bridge. René van der Vlist is one of the guides. And for the full interview, you heard a bit of last week on this show with Rob van der Zon, where he speculates on who he believes the goddess is at the top of the obelisk at the Hartenstein Museum in Oosterbeek and why she's there. You can listen to Dialect here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. I think we'll start this week, Martin, with the alleged Russian hacking operation starting at the World Anti-Doping Agency in Canada announced this week.
Well, it seems to me that these so-called cyber attacks are not something that's happened recently. They've suddenly decided at this moment to accuse the Russians of cyber attacking these various institutions. And basically, I have to be honest with you, I don't believe a word they say. Basically, I think they're making it all up.
So you're saying that all of these, let me just run through them. Mm. In Canada, the World Anti-Doping Agency, the Sport and Anti-Doping Agencies and a Nuclear Technology Company in the United States, Sport and Anti-Doping Agencies in Brazil, the MH17 plane crash investigation in Malaysia, in Switzerland, the World Anti-Doping Agency and Chemical Weapons Watchdog, in the Netherlands, the Chemical Weapons Watchdog, which is where the report came out as well, about these two Russians hanging around this week. And also in Britain, the Foreign Office has been hacked, as has the Ministry of Defence.
Now, we're talking about hacking here. Now, what exactly has happened in each particular case? Have they introduced malware? They haven't said that. Now, GCHQ, just down the road here, they spend their whole day, there's a whole staff there, and they spend millions of pounds each year. What do you think they're doing? They're listening to foreign communications. Probably, in all the kind of organisations that you've just listed, the Russians supposedly hacking into. Now, if we're going to get rid of hacking, perhaps we should cancel GCHQ at all. We don't need GCHQ, do we? What does GCHQ do? GCHQ does hacking in those terms. Now, would it be surprising if the signals intelligence of the Russians was doing exactly the same thing as GCHQ, which is listening to what other people are talking about? Because that's what they do. Well, that's what they're there for.
The one thing I point out here is it's very easy to conceal the actual origin of a cyber attack by using proxy service in different countries. In fact, a whole series you can do. And there's been no proper evidence put forward with these accusations
to
show how they know the Russians have done this. Now, of course, the Ministry of Defence and others will say, oh, well, we can't give you that evidence because that would give away our techniques for finding. So you basically just have to take it on trust.
Yeah, and why should we take it on trust? The Western intelligence services engage in information warfare. They've engaged in information warfare in the Ukraine, where evidence has come out through a court case, no court cases here, you'll notice, that the snipers, professional snipers that killed the pro-EU demonstrators in the run-up to the coup in Ukraine, because it was a coup, were actually orchestrated by the current regime.
But that's not a cyber
attack. No, but that's a real court case where NATO intelligence services have been fingered for murdering 80 people.
Okay, but this
so
is
why should we believe them when they say the Russians are cyber attacking them? They need to be dismantled and put under democratic control.
It's not just Britain,
a bit like the old KGB or the Gestapo.
It's not just Britain that's saying it. It's also Australia and New Zealand.
Well, it's also
accusing Russian military intelligence of carrying out a worldwide campaign of malicious cyber attacks, including the hacking of the US Democratic National Committee in 2016. British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt said in a statement on Thursday this week that the country's National Cyber Security Centre, NCSC, had found, that's I suppose something to do with GCHQ, had found Russian GRU intelligence service operatives were behind cyber attacks believed to have cost the global economy millions of dollars. I don't see how many millions exactly. Australia,
don't suppose they know
Australia
either.
And New Zealand released similar statements alleging that their own intelligence agencies had also found evidence of Russian involvement, the same attacks on political, business, media and sporting institutions. They're all members of the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Alliance, which also includes the US and Canada. The GRU's actions, they say, are reckless and indiscriminate. They try to undermine and interfere in elections in other countries. They're even prepared to damage Russian companies and Russian citizens, Jeremy Hunt said in a statement. And I'll put a link up to that CNN article on our show page.
All right. There's a whole list of allegations there, but let's just pick on the one substantial one, which is the so-called hacking of the Democratic National Committee. Now, we've got quite a lot of information about this, because in actual fact, the source of this information was WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks got hold of not a hack, but a leak from inside the Democratic National Committee, which looks as if it came from Seth Rich, who was one of the key IT people, who was subsequently murdered in very murky circumstances. And we've got overwhelming evidence from WikiLeaks, from Julian Assange, and from Craig Murray, who used to be British ambassador in Uzbekistan, who flew to Washington to collect the material, that leak came from inside the DNC. Now, what the FBI and the CIA have been claiming since then is that what the email showed, the leak or hack, whatever it was, showed, is that the whole of the primary process of the Democratic Party was rigged to prevent Bernie Sanders being the candidate for the Democrats in the election of that year. Now, in other words, if Sanders had been given a fair run and had got the nomination, he might well have beaten Trump. And we might be talking about President Sanders talking to President Putin and President Xi Jinping about world peace. But we're not, because the whole thing was rigged. And it wasn't rigged. Even the FBI and CIA admit that the Russians didn't rig the effects. What they say is this shows American democracy in a bad light, and therefore it must have been the Russians that got this information out there because they want to show America in a bad light. See the bad faith of that kind of argument. American democracy is hacked. It is rigged, but it's not rigged by the Russian secret services. It's rigged by the Western secret services. And all the other allegations that they make, do you know what? If you're in a court of law and you've shown to be lying about one thing, none of your testimony about anything else is acceptable. Now, we know that the Western intelligence services engage in murder, hacking, and political subversion all over the world. We've got evidence from court cases going back decades. Now, that's not to say that the Russians are squeaky clean, but I don't believe a word that comes out of the Western intelligence services, including Australia and New Zealand. They are just puppets of the US, just as we are.
Some people disagree with you. One of them is the BBC's Anna Holligan, and she reports now on a reconnaissance dossier of Russians, which has been released by the Dutch government in The Hague this week.
We've just come out of a press conference, and this is the case file released by the Dutch intelligence service, but it reads more like a spy novel. We've been given a whole case file of information about how four alleged Russian GRU intelligence operatives arrived here in the Netherlands and conducted an operation in April 2018. I'll run you through it very quickly, chronologically. They've managed to collect taxi receipts that show a journey from the GRU barracks in Moscow to Moscow Airport on the day these four men travelled to the Netherlands. They have photographs of them at Schiphol Airport with a member of the Russian embassy. Then they have photographs seized from a laptop which show a reconnaissance mission around the headquarters of the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog, which, of course, at the time was investigating the attack in Salisbury on Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia.
Well, these are allegations against... If you're carrying out cyber attacks, you don't actually send...
It's not just allegations, is it? She's presented, and the Dutch intelligence have presented with lots of evidence there.
No, what they've showed is that GRU... What they claim are GRU operatives went to Holland, and they've said, we've sent them back. Now, when you've sent them back, is what they've done, they've not been put on trial. They've not been charged with anything. And I put it to the listeners. Intelligence services' main function is to tell lies. The Russian intelligence services no doubt tell strategic lies... So do ours. And they're working for a war with Russia because they want to build up their own spending on military expenditure. And there's a campaign of vilification against the Russian state, which is actually probably the most democratic state the Russians have ever had. They're pretty fed up with it, and I understand why.
Alexei Morenets, 41 years old, and Yevgeny Serebryakov, 37 years old, were described by the Dutch officials as cyber operators. Now, what were they doing? Hanging around the OCPW. OCPW, which is there investigating their attack in Salisbury. Why are they hanging around
If they're cyber operators, why do they get on a plane and fly to Holland anyway? You sit on a computer console like Brigade 77.
Okay, so what they're doing, what they're doing, Martin, is they're standing outside the OPCW, hacking into it physically from outside it.
Really? That's what they say, is it? Why should we believe them? Last week, we covered all the stuff around the Battle of Arnhem and the Dutch intelligence services being infiltrated by the Nazis and all the rest of it. Why should we... Just because they are the intelligence services, why are we supposed to believe everything they say? In actual fact, I would argue that intelligence services should be disbelieved unless they can show that they're telling the truth. That's got to be the rule.
The other side of this is, have they actually got any evidence that these guys committed any crimes while they were there?
Well, indeed.
Doesn't look as if they did.
No, that's why they're expelled instead of put on trial. So if they went on trial, they'd have to come up with the evidence,
wouldn't
they?
Let's have a listen to the second half of this clip from the BBC's Anna Holligan, where she talks about the discovery by the Dutch intelligence that these people had left a laptop there where they'd been doing Google searches. They had Wi-Fi records there too.
Now, they've even gathered together things like Google Maps, train tickets. He raised the question in this press conference, the Dutch intelligence officer, how do we know that these men weren't just on holiday here in The Hague? A nod, of course, to the Salisbury suspects' claim that they were simply tourists. And he said, well, look, they checked into the Marriott Hotel. They even took their litter away. That's not something that holidaymakers do. But beyond that, they had photographs of a number of mobile phones, a laptop which had a history of Google searches. Also, they checked into Wi-Fi hotspots. And I think beyond everything else, perhaps what's most surprising about this is that these men, who are allegedly members of President Putin's most elite military units, the GRU, could make what some people would characterise as such beginner's mistakes in leaving behind such a paper trail.
Well, I'm not sure if they did manage to get any information when they were there, but I can remember at the time, this is around about April this year, that the Russian media did announce that they believed that there were people working for the OPCW that thought that there was no Novichok used in Salisbury whatsoever, that actually, because no one had died and the symptoms weren't those of Novichok, because people die when they get Novichok poisoning, that actually the OPCW, some people within that organisation, were saying that it was much more likely to be this BZ nerve gas, which is actually a way of disabling troops, but it doesn't kill them. So it's potentially these guys that realised that there was some dissent going on within the OPCW office. So they weren't necessarily there to do anything malicious. And I find it rather strange that all of the implications of these are that there was some sort of malice involved, and this is yet more evidence of Russian malice to the global system.
We've now reached situation where the Russians are accused of just about anything you can think of. Yeah, I mean, as we discussed the other week, the so-called Skripal murderers spent the night before their murder getting stoned and having noisy sex with prostitutes in their hotel, which of course you would do if you were a GRU operative. I sent you that article like this week, or you sent it to me, of an Israeli assassin, and of course they admitted that they've carried out 2,500 murders in the last decade.
2,700.
In the last decade, yeah. And they said, well, that's not how you do it at all. And he gave a, and we can perhaps put the link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and people can read what an Israeli intelligence officer who's been involved in assassinations says about all of this. None of this adds up. That's not how you do assassinations at all. And, of course, most of the public haven't got a clue about this.
Well, we'll definitely
and they just
say
Russians,
that,
Novichok, war...
We'll weapons. We'll definitely
freak
do
out.
That. We'll put a link up to our show page about that. But there is actually on thisweek.org.uk, but there is another aspect to all of this. The cyber attacks particularly. I can remember we were discussing this end of last year, beginning of this year, that the military doctrine was that if NATO countries were attacked by a cyber attack, that this gave the military the option to retaliate with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I mean, that is... NATO doctrine has always never been to say that we wouldn't use nuclear weapons first. Most people don't realise it, but that's the doctrine. And that's supposed to keep the other side on edge. And, of course, it does keep them on edge and makes us all less safe than we'd otherwise be. But the idea that... this whole idea of cyber attacks is totally hyped. Yeah, the idea that elections can be hacked. Well, they can't be hacked if you're using paper ballots. It's only if you're using electronic equipment that they can be hacked. And so what they do is they introduce electronic equipment and then scream as if they're being hacked. And, of course, the elections are hacked, but they aren't being hacked by the Russians. They're being hacked by our own intelligence services. Our own intelligence services are far more powerful than people realise. They basically run the show. The politicians are just the front people. And that's been going on for donkey's years. Everybody in Russia knows that this is the way the real world works, because they lived in a totalitarian state. In the West, people would presume that the intelligence services are just there to protect us, which is absolutely absurd when you look at the history of their actual behaviour.
Okay. Now, the Israeli you were talking about is a guy called Alexander Brass, and he says it's absolutely absurd, the story that we're being spun about what happened in Salisbury. He said in any operation that... if you wanted to eliminate someone, it's a very serious operation. It's prepared for a very long time in advance. You're talking about dozens of employees. He said, isn't in the operation a technical support group, a logistic group, a cover group, an external surveillance group, and a group of performers are involved. The performers themselves appear at the very last moment. They do not go anywhere. They don't appear on any cameras. They don't go on public transport. They move on rented cars, which they do not rent themselves. And the more, they will not stop in hotels either, and they stay in safe houses provided by the logistics group, another group in such an operation. Such groups do not come under the passport of their country or go to the embassy for obtaining any visas or leaving any fingerprints.
Yeah, well, that's a professional intelligence officer telling you how real hits are carried out. And, of course, the Israelis have admitted that they've carried out 2,700 such hits in the last... They're our allies, by the way. 2,700... All illegal, of course. Murdering people's illegal.
So what he said is... this is Alexander Brass. He said it was a rough provocation by the British Special Services. In my opinion, he says this is obvious.
Well, he's a professional intelligence officer and he knows what he's talking about. It's a provocation by the British. Now, if the British are engaged in provocations in Salisbury, perhaps they're also engaged in provocations in Amsterdam.
I haven't seen...
And provocations around the world.
I haven't seen Anna Holligan on the BBC either quoting him or interviewing him.
No, because basically they don't do their jobs properly, these people, and they're well paid for not doing them properly.
So let's also have a look at the more general picture here by dipping in again to Theresa May's speech at the Conservative Party conference, where she also talks about the central dangerous role of Russia in Britain's threat to Britain's national security. She sees Putin as a key figure there.
And that's what this job is all about, taking the big decisions and doing so in the national interest. That is never more true than when our national security is threatened. Those are the times when I feel most keenly the responsibilities of my office. When I have to ask our brave servicemen and women to put themselves in harm's way, to protect our citizens, to support our allies as we would expect them to support us, to uphold the international rules on which our security depends. Like when the Syrian regime attacked Douma with chemical weapons, killing innocent men, women and children. We joined with our friends to send a message that the use of chemical weapons will never be tolerated. I took the decision to send RAF jets to strike against Assad's chemical weapons facilities. As Prime Minister, I had to make the call and then be held to account for it. The same was true when Russia launched a chemical attack on the streets of the United Kingdom. I took the decision to expel 23 Russian diplomats who were undeclared intelligence officers. Our allies joined us in degrading Russia's intelligence network. In Parliament, I received almost universal support. From the SNP to the Liberal Democrats and the Labour backbenches, there was just one dissenting voice, Jeremy Corbyn, dismissing the findings of our security services, suggesting that the country responsible for the attack should double-check the findings of our chemical weapons scientists, refusing to lay the blame squarely where it belonged. Just imagine if he were Prime Minister. He says Britain should disarm herself in the hope others follow suit. I say no, we must keep our defences strong to keep our country safe. He says a strong NATO simply provokes Russia. I say no, it is the guarantor of our freedom and security. He poses as a humanitarian, but he says that military action to save lives is only justified with the approval of the Security Council, effectively giving Russia a veto. I say no. We cannot outsource our conscience to the Kremlin.
Crikey, that was a long bit of applause there. We can't outsource our conscience to the Kremlin. She's saying actually there shouldn't be a veto for Russia at the UN Security Council.
Yeah, well, that's what the British have been pushing for, to basically change the international architecture. So modern democratic Russia, it's what the most democratic government it's ever had, is to be excluded from the Security Council on the say-so of Great Britain. And, of course, she talked there about the chemical weapons attack in Douma. There's not a shred of evidence that there was a chemical weapons attack. There have been chemical weapons in the attacks in the past.
Well, she's been just watching the BBC and seeing what's on the news, hasn't she?
Also, she's just been listening to her intelligence service. She's always been very close to the intelligence services, Theresa May. She's very much their puppet. And of course, we then bombed with no Security Council resolution. Britain, France, and the US bombed Syria. They were lucky that they didn't fire back, because under international law, they've got the absolute right to fire back. And they should have actually, if the Russians could have decided, right, we're going to hit Akrotiri in Cyprus. Let me just finish, Tony. Akrotiri in Cyprus shouldn't even be there, because the people of Cyprus don't want a British base there. They don't. People of Bahrain don't want a base there either. So all of this old talk about NATO and all the rest of it, the world has moved on.
Well, she's saying
the world has moved on, and we're
saying,
on the brink of World War
Martin,
III,
what she's
and we don't
saying,
need that kind of
what
talk.
What she's
frankly.
Saying is we are not outsourcing our conscience to Russia at the UN Security Council. We are not going to accept their veto.
No. Well, then why should they accept the US veto on Israel's misbehaviour? The Russians could say, no, we're not accepting your veto on the, because, of course, when the Israelis do anything wrong, the US vetoes it. And the Russians could say, well, we're not going to accept an American veto. So we are going to strike Israel.
Well, quietly.
Why not?
Quietly in the
back. They're very violent. Maybe the only message that, I'm not a pacifist, Tony.
Quietly.
Maybe people who go to war have got to accept the consequences of people fighting
quietly
back.
In the background, the Chinese at the UN Security Council are being unscrutable, aren't they? They're saying, well, what's going on here? Well, and what is their attitude to international law, then? If Britain's attitude is, well, we're just going to disregard the UN Security Council now.
Well, the attitude will be if the UN Security Council doesn't mean anything, then we don't have to take any notice of the UN Security Council, do we? If our veto doesn't mean anything in it, then maybe we're going to come to it and we'll carry on voting against you. But as international law now stands, the intervention in Yugoslavia over Kosovo was illegal. Now, there's been the invasion of Iraq was illegal. Now, when she talks about taking responsibility, if a major war had broken out because of her decision to put RAF Akrotiri into bombing mode on Syria, if the Syrians and the Russians had fought back, for example, by shooting at Akrotiri and killing hundreds of RAF service personnel, and then it turned into a major war, like the war in Iraq, which has killed a million people. And has Tony Blair been sent to The Hague for that? And, of course, our allies, the US, have just said we're not interested in international law, not at The Hague, not at the UN. We don't do international law. I want to say to Theresa May, you can keep your conscience, because your conscience really needs to be examined about what you've been doing. Never mind what the Russians have been doing, what you've been doing.
Well, what about the cladding gurus at Grenfell Tower? Have any of those been even arrested?
Well, we're talking geopolitics now.
What I'm saying is that's not just in geopolitics terms. No. It's also domestic, isn't it?
Well, of course, in actual fact, but what really sickens me about Theresa May's speech there is the school marmish attitude towards everybody else in the world. We are right. We are the British. We know who we are. And we're the best in the world. And everybody else, they really got to listen to us, because we know we never get anything wrong, and we're completely in the right and they're completely in the wrong.
Yeah, after 2003 and after the Iraq War.
Yeah, yeah. The France and Germany voted against in the UN Security Council, including every other Commonwealth country apart from Australia. But we ignored all of that and we went to war. And we said at the time this is going to be a disaster. Oh, and it'll take a few weeks. It'll all be sorted out. We're years later now, and it hasn't been sorted out or anything like sorted out. In fact, the war's spread and grown. And of course, if she carries on talking like that, we really could have a proper, real big Middle East war with loads of people killed. And will she take responsibility for that and go to The Hague? I wonder. I doubt it.
On antiwar.com today, Associated Press are saying that the US military program, a US military program, could be seen as a bioweapon. A research arm of the US military is exploring the possibility of deploying insects to make plants more resilient by altering their genes. But some experts say the work is seen as a potential biological weapon. As an opinion paper published on Thursday in the journal Science, the authors say the US needs to provide greater justification for peacetime purpose of its Insect Allies project to avoid being perceived as a hostile to other countries. Other experts expressed ethical and security concerns with the research, which seeks to transmit protective traits to crops already growing in the field. Now, bioweapons, is that... I mean, surely all they're trying to do here, kind of jumping ahead, isn't it? All they're trying to do here in the US is to do some sort of basic bits of genetic engineering to allow things like less aphids on plants. But why might some people see that as a bioweapon?
Well, there are bioweapons out there, and there are chemical weapons out there, like Agent Orange, which was sprayed all over Vietnam. Did anybody in America go to court for any or punished for any of that? When Fallujah was attacked by Mad Dog Mattis, they used white phosphorus. The Israelis used white phosphorus in Gaza. So we can use chemical weapons, but you can't. And, of course, in actual fact, the Russians don't use chemical weapons in general. They dismantled their version of Porton Down in the 1990s in Uzbekistan when Craig Murray was our ambassador over there. And in actual fact, this talk of chemical weapons is just trying to blacken. And the whole like, oh, chemical weapons are terrible. But of course, the weaponry supplied to the jihadis inside Syria, which has killed thousands and thousands of people, and the SAS are still there training people to do it, that's okay.
In the US,
ordinary bullets are all right, US, chemical weapons we've got to worry about.
In the US as well yesterday, Pentagon is claiming near limitless power to conduct unauthorised strikes. Officials are arguing collective self-defence is being too broadly interpreted. Senators are pushing for clarification from the Pentagon about their interpretation of the concept of collective self-defence, in inverted commas, under which the US military claims near limitless powers to conduct unilateral strikes on enemies not authorised by Congress or the UN. The expansion of the notion that military forces have the right to self-defence if they're attacked was expanded to a collective right which allows the US to intervene when anyone the Pentagon identifies as a partner is is either under attack or faces a conceivable threat from someone else. Pentagon's affirmed in recent correspondence with Senator Kaine, K-A-I-N-E, that this is how they view things, and that moreover it's not typically limited to particular groups or individuals committing a hostile act or demonstrating hostile intent. This means in effect they can attack the targets. Congress has never authorised them as long as they select some partner that could benefit from that attack.
Well, the original Constitution of the United States made was pretty clear that Congress had was the only body empowered to declare war. And of course what's happened is the so-called imperial presidency has gradually taken over that function. It was never supposed to be the function of the president to declare war, but of course it's not even the president who runs things in the US, it's the Pentagon. And dare I say it, it's not even Theresa May who runs things in this country.
Also,
it's the intelligence service and the military working for the Americans.
Well, she certainly does seem to be just sitting there reading a script, doesn't she? Doesn't sound like there's a lot of depth.
Let's get real.
She's saying. Mattis over in the US says that America is to respond to blatant Russian violation of arms treaties. He says the US is reviewing options to respond diplomatically or militarily. Just days after the US Ambassador Kay Bailey Hutchinson threatened to start a war against Russia by preemptively destroying a certain type of Russian missiles over a perceived violation of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, Defense Secretary James Mattis is continuing the saber-rattling. He's claimed Russia is in blatant violation of the INF and that the US will not allow the cavalier disregard to continue. He says the US is reviewing a series of potential diplomatic and military options to be taken about it and that non-acting is untenable. Unlike Hutchinson, whose comments gave the impression that a major war was imminent, Mattis was very cautious about not providing any specifics, saying he would not get into details about what sort of response the US would be likely to take. The INF treaty issue has been going on for years, with the US objecting to a certain Russian test. Russia insists that missiles in no way violate the INF. There appears to have been little attempt to discuss the matter at all between the two countries. So this is another bit of saber-rattling. But also, the US would... this is also from antiwar.com. US would preemptively destroy Russian warheads, an envoy warns. The US ambassador to NATO, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, threatened war against Russia in comments on Tuesday. So this is actually part of that same story, the previous bit, saying the US was, sorry for doing them in the reverse order, was prepared to preemptively take out Russian missiles that the US objects to Russia having. So this is quite serious if NATO are actually threatening to strike Russian forces. I mean, I don't think the Americans would like it very much if it was the other way around.
Well, the problem with saying things like that is the Russian generals might come to the conclusion that that's exactly what they've got to do, because they've got to get their retaliation in first. And if you think about it, they've been putting these missiles, anti-ballistic missiles, into Romania and Poland, which actually are right on the Russian border. So they could carry out a preemptive strike to decapitate Moscow in the hopes that the button wouldn't be pressed and they wouldn't fire back. Now, just imagine what would happen if the Russians were to put in the missiles that they've got inside Russia in Cuba. We don't have to ask. We know what happened. Now, the Russians are getting pretty fed up of NATO pushing these missiles right in their face. And when they create countermeasures, they're then accused of breaking the INF. Now, the INF treaty was signed between Gorbachev and Reagan in the 80s, and basically it took these short-range missiles out of the equation and got rid of anti-ballistic missiles so that nobody could do a first strike. That's all been ripped up unilaterally by the US. The US is spoiling for a fight with Russia. The Russians are trying to avoid it, and they're getting pretty fed up with the attitude. But if we do trip over, They won't just get a pushover. For obvious things that might happen if there's a war in Syria, is everybody in Akrotiria better get their tin hats on? Because if I was the Russian commanders, I would just incinerate that base. Kill everybody in it.
Love Bristol. Love. BCFM. 93.2.
Well, over to Malaysia now, or as it used to be called, Malaya. We are looking this week at the Batang Kali massacre. The European Court has rejected a call for a probe into this massacre of 24 Malaysia rubber plantation workers by British troops in 1948, saying it came too late. Relatives of the workers waged a decades-long fight for an inquiry into the massacre, which occurred on the 12th of December 1948 during what's known as the Malay Emergency, when Commonwealth forces fought a communist-inspired revolt in what was then a British colony. But the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, eastern France this week, which hears complaints about violations of the European Convention, rejected the position petition as inadmissible. Now, I find this fascinating, particularly because it was compared to the My Lai massacre, which was far, far worse. 500 were killed there by American troops in Vietnam. And also, Martin, about I thought it was an opportunity to bring up this very little known about, little talked about famine, where 25 million Chinese starved to death between 1958 and 1961, which is hardly mentioned.
Well, the Great Leap Forward is well known to those who are students of Chinese history.
It wasn't really a great leap forward.
It wasn't a great leap forward. It was a disastrous policy pursued by Mao to try and industrialise in one go. And you know, there's all sorts of stupidities associated with that era in Chinese politics.
So what caused the famine?
Well, what caused the famine is they'd collectivised the peasantry, much against their will. And then, at first, the land reforms that they brought in were popular because they're basically giving people the land. Then they took it back, took it off everybody. And then they were then told to try and, everybody was going to try and produce steel in backyard furnaces, which was just totally unviable, magical thinking. And of course, eventually, of course, the food production collapsed and then all these people died, which is pretty silly. But, you know, that's when you talk about numbers of people dying in Chinese famines, you know, there were famines in the 19th century when the British were running the show, basically, the Taiping Rebellion and all the rest of it. And millions of people do die in China because there are millions of them. You know, anything that goes wrong in China has huge impact because there's so many Chinese, you know, so a lot of them die if they
there's
get things wrong.
There's also a massive famine in Ukraine, wasn't there?
In the 30s,
in the 1930s. Anyway, famines aside, let's go back to Malaysia, or Malaya as it was then, and hear from former SAS officer Barry Wynn, who he's been on this show before once or twice, but he was actually over there, and he did what I thought was a really wonderful thing, which is he stood alongside the villagers and said, actually, I think we did the wrong thing here, even though I think he was in the Devon Regiment, not in the Scots Guards, who were involved in this massacre. And he explains what it was like as a young man being sent over, just after the Second World War, over to Southeast Asia.
My name is Barry Wynn. I'm talking about an incident which took place in 1948. At that time, the British Army became involved in the first anti-colonial war after the Second World War. And that took place in the jungles and the country of Malaysia. It was estimated that during the late 40s, more than 7,000 battle-hardened communist guerrillas were active all over Malaya, killing some 3,000 unarmed citizens and 2,000 police and soldiers. I was 18 at the time, and this incident, which is called the Batangkali Massacre, took place in December 1948. I had just been trained by Special Forces Infantry Training Group in Northern Ireland, taken a year, and I was on my way to Hong Kong, where my regiment, the 1st Battalion of the Devon Regiment, was then situated, having been transferred from Burma, where they fought. So I, newly commissioned, was on a troop ship bound for Hong Kong. And when we were going through the Suez Canal, we were suddenly informed, in true British Army fashion, that we were not going to Hong Kong, that the regiment in Hong Kong was now on its way to Singapore, and that I was to get off at Singapore and be prepared for immediate action. In fact, this coming Christmas will be the 70th anniversary of the Batangkali massacre. I was, on the days that this took place, myself in the jungle with my troops fighting this very difficult battle. The fact was that in those days, the British Army had virtually been disbanded after the Second World War, and we were young conscripts, and I was, as I say, 18 at the time. when we arrived in Singapore, to my absolute amazement, my company commander told me we're doing a shore landing on an island called Paula Taikong in 2 days' time from invasion barges. You can imagine that I only just met my own troops. We were told that the Mao communist guerrillas were already occupying this island, and of course it was all panic stations at that time because of the way the Japanese had taken the Malaysian Peninsula, and that we were immediately sent in to quell this apparent invasion. The Chinese communists under Mao Zedong were in fact fighting the Japanese during the war. They were fighting the Japanese, and we armed the Chinese communist guerrillas who were operating all over Malaya. And of course, when the atom bomb was dropped on Japan, suddenly we found that the Allies, that's the Chinese communists, managed to steal all the weaponry we had supplied to them from Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, and the Cocos Islands, and they took up arms against us. So we suddenly were trying to, what we thought at the time, was hold the British Empire together. Within weeks, I and my platoon were up country in one of the worst communist-dominated areas, which was North Johor. We were badly armed. We had no jungle boots, and we were trying to put down this insurrection. It took 12 years before this was completed, about the same time as the British Army was in Afghanistan. But we, the British, sustained more casualties in Malaysia than did the British Army in Afghanistan. But nobody today knows anything about it. And this actually took place even 2 years before the Korean conflict.
So Barry Wynn was doing this jungle warfare. It was really, I suppose, an attempt to save face.
We were trying to put down this insurrection. We were searching villages. And, of course, in these villages, you had young men who, during the day, were rubber tappers, and at night time got into their uniforms and black dress and attacked the mining operations, the rubber plantations, and created hell on earth. But they were very, very difficult to distinguish. So during the day, you go, say, into the rice fields, and there'd be young men doing their work in the paddy fields, and you could not distinguish them. I mean, you didn't know whether they were suspects or not. And their tactics at the time were really hit and run. So they had jungle camps into which they'd put all the armory that we had sent them to fight the Japanese, which they had filched from the British Army, and they came out of these camps in the jungle or from the villages and the rice fields and attacked the British. So it was a kind of a hit-and-run situation, and we very seldom saw them. They sniped, killed a couple of troops and disappeared, and you know, it was extremely difficult. So we were dealing with ambushes. And to give you an idea, I was shot at on one occasion in 24 hours, three times at less than 10 paces, which was fairly exhilarating. They weren't very good shots, fortunately. In fact, one of the incidents, I was shot at by a Chinese policeman. At another one, I had entered the bandit camp. I, in fact, was the leading man on the patrol, and as we were going, I didn't know I was about to enter a bandit camp. It was the first bandit camp that my regiment found, and the man in front of me, who was an ex-para, I suddenly saw him tense. And that second, by now we'd become very experienced jungle fighters, when I saw him tense, I hurled myself to the ground, and the machine guns just simply zipped across my head for about maybe half a minute, and the leaves were coming down like blossom blown in the wind. So they weren't very good shots, and that was the kind of situation that we faced. They would hit for a few minutes and then disappear. In fact, on that occasion, I never saw who it was that was shooting. The jungle is so thick that 2 feet in front of me, you can't see anything. And true to our training and what I tried to instill into my men, never fire until you see who the hell you're firing at. And in fact, I never even pulled the trigger. And after about a minute or 2 minutes of very, very considerable automatic fire, they suddenly stopped and disappeared. Never saw them, but I did find their camp. And when reinforcements arrived the following morning, we went in and destroyed it. That was the kind of thing. It was very, very, very difficult. And the morale of our men, which was generally pretty high, but they were very exasperated because you couldn't hit back, because you never saw them.
Now, when you got a flavour of what jungle warfare was like, here Barry talks about the actual massacre itself.
It was really a straightforward thing. You're to go to this village, surround it, find all the people in it, especially the young men, and the police will come and interrogate. That was basically the instruction. But on this occasion, this patrol was not led by officers who were really much better trained, to be honest with you, to understand all the implications. It doesn't mean that the sergeants weren't excellent, and they were excellent and well-trained, and I was trained by the Brigade of Guards, and you couldn't want a better disciplined lot of men anywhere in the world. So, but they are usually very tall. The jungle is very dense. They had not been trained in jungle warfare, and they were being shot at. And in fact, on one occasion, I remember, when some of them were bathing in the river, which they shouldn't have been, they were badly shot up, and 3 of them were killed. So that soon gets around. So this patrol was sent to surround the village, see if there were any people, because there'd been a lot of action in the area, to see if there were any young men there, and if they were, to separate them from the women and the children, put them in a hut for the night, and then they would be interrogated by the civil police. That was the brief. But what actually happened, there are 2 distinct stories, and I'll try and give it to you. It is claimed that the men were Chinese terrorists and were gunned down trying to escape. This version was accepted by the British authorities, which stated 2 weeks after the incident, after careful consideration of the evidence and a personal visit to where the incident occurred, the Attorney General is satisfied that the suspects would have made good their escape had the security forces not opened fire. It is not proposed to take any further action in this incident. I had just come back from the jungle, and this was reported in the Straits Times. And after I had given a debrief to my company commander, he pushed over a copy of the Straits Times. I think it was dated the 12th of December, 1948. And he said, look at this. We've just managed to kill 24 of these blasted people. And I said, well, I wish I could find 24 of them to kill. We've never seen them even. He said then, Barry, words are getting around that they weren't armed. And that was the beginning. And that story has continued over 70 years. And when Dennis Healy decided that there should be an investigation, and Scotland Yard were brought into it, because one or two of these Scottish ex-soldiers now living in their civilian life, 20 or 30 years later, had let it be known the 24 victims were unarmed. And they signed witness confessions about this. And therefore, it's always been thought to be a cover-up situation.
Well, that's Barry Wynn there, and his attitude, Martin, is it's time to draw a line under this, but there would be no harm at all for the British actually apologising, since it was pretty clear that these guys were unarmed when they were shot.
Yeah, it's a sad story, isn't it? And, of course, the ultimate question you have to ask yourself is, should Britain run Malaysia? Or should the Malaysians run Malaysia?
Or should the Chinese at the time? That was the other
Well, there's probably a big Chinese population in Malaysia. They're not the majority. And there's tension between the Chinese and the Malays. Nevertheless, the British have really no right to be in Malaysia in the first place. And that's one of the problems, isn't it?
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Finally, a story that you just pointed out to me, Martin, which I'd managed to miss. Two members of the famous Lopresti ice cream family facing modern slavery charges. Sam Lopresti, this is the family of the Bristol... not Bristol North West, is it? It's Bradley Stoke and Filton, Conservative MP and Freemason, Jack Lopresti. Two members of the famous family charged with modern slavery offences and also requiring a person to perform forced labour. In addition, Sam Lopresti has been charged with assault, occasioning actual bodily harm.
Well, I mean, it's innocent till proved guilty, but it's an interesting development, isn't it?
Finally this week, there's an event tomorrow starting at midday at the Ark Bar on Broad Street, which is being organised by a group called Windows on the World. They're calling it The Bigger Picture. I've had a chat to Mark Windows, who's going to be one of the people down there. Also, Piers Corbyn, the brother of the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, and one or two other people, really talking about how our local government and our central government is being corporatised, privatised quietly behind the scenes. So let's have a listen to him now.
If you want to control and manage resources and population, you need a plan. And that plan is now global and has been for quite a long time. And for instance, people can look at things like the Habitat conferences every year, every 2 years actually, they're biennial now. But they dictate housing policy. Now, all this high density housing that's being introduced into areas. I mean, I've seen London and areas of London, so-called regeneration areas, have changed completely within 3 years. They've changed out of all recognition to what they were. And say I lived in a borough called Waltham Forest. It didn't change for 25 years. How come in 3 years all the infrastructure changed? 70 roads closed with no public consultation, people saying we didn't vote for this, and nobody seems to be able to know where it came from or what can be done about it. So basically, we're giving people the tools to look at this, and it's not actually that complicated. And once you look at it as a system, it makes complete sense. But if you can't see it as for what it is, then it's incredibly difficult to understand and it starts to look a bit mind-blowing. And that's what I want to do with this talk. We've got all the quotes and all of the documents that people can look at. And we've now got people all over the country sending us documents which prove that this is what's going on in local councils. So councils are now becoming these mega regions. In other words, lots of local authorities are joining together. Just look that up. What this is about is public consultation is being removed. And that's what these talks are about. And basically what you can do to take back some kind of power locally. And we are actually having some success with this.
Where and when can people see what you're up to, Mark?
Well, we're at the Arc Centre in Bristol on Saturday, the 6th of October. And it's from midday. It's going to be myself and Piers Corbyn. We talk about the housing, the regeneration that's going on all over the country, the background to that. And then we go into the bigger picture of the global action plan, which is affecting everybody locally. And we have Sandy Adams as well talking about the background and the implementation of Agenda 21. And all this is actually from a perspective of people who've done lots of research on it. So we've actually got the documentation and everything. So, yeah, we're in Bristol on Saturday. It's windowsontheworld.net. We're going to be there all day from 12 a.m.
And if no one does anything, what's Bristol going to look like in 20 years' time?
Well, that's a really good question, because with the rollout of 5G and what's going on with the Internet of Things, my word would probably be dystopia, because that's what I see being rolled out now. The way places are changing, especially in cities, is to me, draconian. It's a corporate takeover of everything. So I would say that we're just going to see very sterile places with no individuality and a completely controlled and managed population with no private transport and being put into these high-density housing places where people are monitored and surveilled 24 hours a day.
OK, that's all for this. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Do please join Mohammed after this. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show...
In Germany, it was 5 to 6 years between Hitler's rise and election and seizure of power and Kristallnacht. So it takes a certain amount of time for the rhetoric to engender a kind of attitude that allows people to tolerate and participate in mass violence. Rwanda, I think it's 1990, 1991... when you first start to find the extreme rhetoric of cockroaches and rats. And so there appears in countries to be a period of several years where people get used to thinking of the targeted groups as being appropriate objects of mass violence.
A conversation on fascism as a tactic and the history of fascism in the United States. Our guest is Yale philosophy professor Jason Stanley. He is the author of the book, How Fascism Works. He joins us next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Two key Republican senators appeared to give a thumbs up to the limited FBI probe of sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Susan Collins of Maine said the new FBI probe appeared to be a very thorough investigation, but said she would go back later to personally read the interviews. Arizona's Jeff Flake, who forced the probe, said he had seen no additional corroborating information to support the sexual assault claims against Kavanaugh. The third undeclared Republican, Lisa Murkowski, did not make herself available for comment. South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham has given full-throated support to Kavanaugh, and he welcomed the results of the new FBI probe.
I'm confident the FBI did a good job. They were not hindered in any way. The focus of the background check was on credible allegations before the committee. I was looking for certain things to be answered by witnesses. I'm more confident than ever that what the committee found is held up and then some.
But Democrats and attorneys for accusers Christine Blasey Ford and Deborah Ramirez criticized the FBI probe for failing to interview key witnesses. Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey called it a cover-up. Ranking Judiciary Committee Democrat Dianne Feinstein said it appeared the White House blocked the FBI from doing its job.
Democrats agreed that the investigation scope should be limited. We did not agree that the White House should tie the FBI's hands. It's simply not credible to say that public testimony in last week's hearing is a substitute for interviews by FBI agents. Not only do senators lack the expertise of FBI agents, we were only given 5 minutes to question Judge Kavanaugh. So, in my view, from what I saw, the investigation was very limited.
The FBI interviewed just 9 people. It did not interview Kavanaugh or Blasey Ford, who said Kavanaugh assaulted her at a high school party decades ago. Attorneys for Blasey Ford said in a statement they are profoundly disappointed that after the tremendous sacrifice she made in coming forward, those directing the FBI investigation were not interested in seeking the truth. Ramirez's lawyers also faulted the limited probe and the failure to follow up on witnesses. Ramirez said could corroborate her account that Kavanaugh thrust his genitals in her face at a Yale party decades ago. After allowing senators to take turns reviewing the one hard copy of the report today, Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell plans to hold an initial cloture vote on limiting debate tomorrow and then proceed to a final vote on confirming Kavanaugh as early as Saturday. Opponents of Kavanaugh's nomination are flocking to Capitol Hill and the Supreme Court. One protest today will feature a march from Kavanaugh's current courthouse as an appellate judge to the U.S. Supreme Court. Vice President Mike Pence accused China of trying to undermine President Trump as the administration deploys tough new rhetoric over Chinese trade, economic, and foreign policies. At the Hudson Institute think tank, Pence said that China was using its power in more proactive and coercive ways to interfere in the domestic policies and politics of the United States. Pence's speech came a week after Trump accused China during a meeting of the UN Security Council of interfering in U.S. elections to help his Democratic rivals. Here's Mike Pence.
These and other actions taken as a whole constitute an intensifying effort to shift American public opinion and policy away from the American first leadership of President Donald Trump. But our message to China's rulers is this: this president will not back down.
Since Trump took office last year, his administration has escalated pressure on China, most recently with several rounds of tit-for-tat economic trade tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of goods. A San Francisco federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from ending protections that have allowed immigrants from 4 countries to live and work legally in the United States. Federal Judge Edward Chen said the move would cause irreparable harm and great hardship. Chen granted a request for a preliminary injunction against the administration's decision to discontinue temporary protected status for people from Sudan, Nicaragua, Haiti, and El Salvador. The judge said there's evidence that President Trump harbors an animus against non-white, non-European immigrants, which influenced his decision to end the TPS designation. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. I think many of us, in thinking about the history of fascism, think of Nazi Germany, Mussolini's Italy, and Franco's post-Civil War Spain. We think, perhaps, of fascism as an adjective. It's a fascist state or a fascist movement or even a fascist party. But our guest today, Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University, argues that fascism is a tactic and that fascism exists even in a non-fascist state. And he points to the history of American racism as our own version of fascism. Jason Stanley is the author of the book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And he now joins us via Skype. Jason Stanley, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
It's a pleasure to be on the program. Thank you, Mitch.
It's good to have you. What role does history play in fascism?
The role of history in fascism is critical. Fascism always starts out with a mythic history. Now, all nationalism starts out with a mythic imagined history. Benedict Anderson reminds us. All nationalism creates this myth of national identity. But not all nationalism creates the particular kind of myth of national identity one finds in fascist movements. In fascist movements, one finds the idea that the mythic national past was glorious, that in the mythic past, the the people of the nation ruled over others. It was patriarchal. Men were men. Women were home raising the next generation. And so it's crucial for fascist movements to control the narrative of history, to create nostalgia for this past that never was, to create this feeling of great loss. That's how Orban came to power with Trianon, by talking about a greater Hungary when Hungary had so much more land.
And they pointed to the fight against the Ottoman Empire.
Yes, because now that's what Orban is doing. Huh. Because Orban wants to position Hungary as the defender of Christian Europe. So now Orban presents an alternative history. He goes back even further to the time at which supposedly Hungary was the great defender of Christian Europe against the Muslim Ottoman Empire, which of course occludes the fact that the Ottoman Empire was in fact quite diverse and many other historical facts.
Also makes me think of Benito Mussolini and his feelings towards the ancient Roman Empire.
Absolutely. You always need to go back to this mythic past. You sort of create a vision of the mythic past to connect your movement with that. And then you promise to make the present like that again. You know, we find this creation of nostalgia. So fascism weaponizes certain emotions to control politics.
You write about this use of history and fascism with the United States concerning the Civil War. Tell me more about that.
Yes, well, we find that, you know, we're having these battles about monuments. Civil War monuments were, of course, erected much later, way after the Civil War, at a time when it was important to create a certain myth about the past, to set the Jim Crow laws on an apparently firm foundation. So the idea being that the Civil War was fought to prevent Northern incursion and Black American corruption, which supposedly led to the end of Reconstruction. So there was this mythic past in the South that justified racial discrimination, and we have that repeatedly employed. You go throughout the South to, for instance, university campuses, and their odes to this mythological struggle against the enemy. And when you hear people in the South, some people in the South speak about that struggle, they speak about it in ultra-nationalist terms. So they speak about it as, you know, well, this, even when they deny it's about slavery, they say it's about the homeland being invaded by foreigners, which is ultra-nationalism. It's kind of, now, it'd be anachronistic to call the Confederacy fascist, but for me, fascism is a sliding scale, and there are many elements of fascism in the Confederacy. There's the white nationalism, and there's this ultra-nationalism, of course, and sort of macho patriarchy.
Is there American fascism?
Oh, there's been American fascism as long as there's been European fascism, and you know, the Ku Klux Klan is hard to distinguish ideologically from the European fascist movements, the 1920s. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan was harshly inveighing against labor unions. They were spreading the conspiracy theory that labor unions were run by Jews in order to foment race wars, which was very similar to what Hitler was saying in the 1920s already, even as early as the 1920s, about Senegalese troops in the Rhineland. He was saying the Jewish plot to get black men raping white German women. There's a huge overlap. Nancy McLean, in her Behind the Mask of Chivalry book from the 90s, documents the overlap in ideology between the 20s Ku Klux Klan and the National Socialists and the European fascist movements. And there was a tremendous amount of influence between the two. So the Hitler is deeply affected by The 1924 immigration by American developments such as the 1924 Immigration Act. Hitler praises the 1924 Immigration Act in Mein Kampf and in his second book. He says it helps create a national state of just the sort that he wants in Germany. So, Hitler hit the Nuremberg laws, as my colleague Jim Whitman has shown in his book, Hitler's American Model. The Nuremberg laws were based on the anti-miscegenation laws of the Jim Crow era. So, as I document in my book, the right to work laws that we now have as law of the land for public unions, they're based in this harsh anti-union rhetoric of the sort that you find in Mein Kampf.
How do you connect that? How do you connect the struggle today over this issue of quote-unquote right to work to what Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf?
Well, trade unions have always been the enemy of fascism. Trade unions connect us across material interests. So, a trade union, we all have aging parents. We all like weekends off. Trade unions connect us across our racial differences. Fascist ideology tries to connect us along our racial identity or our ethnic identity or our gender identity. So it needs to smash any dimension of identity that would make us feel like co-citizens because we share those interests. And that's what trade unions do. In a trade union, when it's functioning correctly, a woman and a man, an African-American and a white American, a Hispanic-American and a non-Hispanic-American are going to get together to plot how to get $2 an hour more. And that is a fundamental threat. And it's also a fundamental threat to an authoritarian leader, because a group of people mobilizing together for their own interests is a potential power source that can inveigh against the dictates of a party in power or a leader. And so labor unions, it's not for nothing that the poem in the Holocaust Museum by Martin Niemöller says, first they came for the socialists, and then they came for the trade unionists.
Multiculturalism is a threat to the fascists.
Absolutely, because fascism is based on an ultranationalism based primarily on ethnic identity. So multiculturalism, multi-ethnic democracy is anathema. And trade unions make us feel economically more secure. Economic insecurity is of aid to fascist government, because when we feel, in Hannah Arendt's words, atomized, then we feel fearful and we need some other identity. We need help from someone. And then we look to demagogues.
What did Hannah Arendt mean by atomized?
She meant that fascism thrives when individuals feel alone, when they feel unsupported and fearful, and they feel that there's nothing there, that they can't trust their fellow citizens, they can't trust institutions, and they're fearful about their economic well-being. She means they're individually atomized, and then they look for an artificial identity, a fake identity, like an ethnic identity, like race. Race is a construction. So the fascist leader offers people a fake identity, one that does not address their material needs or their material interests. And ultimately, the fascist leader offers themselves and loyalty to that leader as their ultimate identity.
I have covered some of these far-right groups, and one term I constantly hear, especially really it's another term for multiculturalism, and that would be cultural Marxism. What does that mean?
Cultural Marxism has a long history. In one sense, it means Jewish.
It means Jewish.
So it's really important for people to read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion to understand what's happening around them. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion says that Jews are behind Marxism, liberalism, capitalism, and, you know, feminism as well. You'd find that trope as well. Homosexuality, that Jews are behind these movements that seek equality for religious, ethnic, and sexual minorities. And cultural Marxism is used as a smear for movements that seek equality for minority groups. So you find people using cultural Marxism to talk about movements for gender equality, movements for gay rights, movements to recognize traditionally oppressed groups like African Americans. You find them tarred as cultural Marxists. And the idea is that it's kind of a conspiracy theory. The idea is what they're really seeking is to take power.
Where did these Protocols of the Elders of Zion come from?
Protocols of the Elders of Zion originated in a work of fiction in the mid-1850s, I believe. I talk about this in my detailed history in my book, How Fascism Works. And then they were taken up in 1905 by a St. Petersburg newspaper as a forgery. So initially there was a discussion in I think it's Maurice Joly in his book. It was a discussion I forget exactly the two characters, but an evil person and a good person. And the evil person is talking about using liberalism as a way to gain power. And so in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, this speech is put in the mouths of the so-called Elders of Zion, that is sort of prominent, sort of a shadowy conspiracy of global Jews. And the idea is they're going to spread liberalism. They're going to use the media. They're going to use education to spread liberalism, to spread freedom. And once you spread liberalism or Marxism to the dominant group, then they will willingly give up their power to you.
We are in conversation with Joseph Stanley. He is the Jacob Borowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University, author of the book How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason Stanley, I found that explanation of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion interesting. So thank you for doing that. I don't want to lose sight of the American Civil War, because you do write extensively about the American Civil War in this book, and in particular about W.E.B. Du Bois and his work called Black Reconstruction. Can you tell me about that?
There may be no more important book to read right now than Black Reconstruction in the American context. Black Reconstruction was published in 1935, at a time at which it was widely believed that the Reconstruction era, the era at which Black Americans in the South were freely allowed to vote and indeed voted en masse and occupied many offices from the Senate to the House to state legislatures. The Reconstruction era was brought to an end because of a myth of Black corruption. So this was widely taught in universities and schools. And even I'm 48 years old, and even I learned that Reconstruction came to an end because Black Americans ran corrupt governments in the South. Du Bois destroys this myth, and he shows that, in fact, Reconstruction ended because poor white laborers in the South and poor Black laborers were starting to band together in a labor movement. And this unified the interests of wealthy whites in the South and wealthy Northern and white industrialists who were threatened by this labor movement. And in this book, in Black Reconstruction, which eventually in the late 1960s was finally recognized to be the true account of the end of Reconstruction, of what happened during Reconstruction. In this book, Du Bois simply gives us so many of the tools we need to understand fascism. He begins the book by saying, you know, in the beginning, God created this world and it was wonderful and everyone got along. And then he threw a Black man in the midst and fascism broke out. So he explicitly uses the term fascism for American racism. So he talks in the book about the psychological wages of whiteness, about which is the crucial thing to explain why poor whites will vote against their own material interests in accord with rich whites against people against poor black Americans with whom they share material interests. So it's a big mystery. Why will poor whites vote to like slash their own health coverage? Why will poor whites vote to slash their own food stamps and government benefits when it hurts them? It hurts themselves. They're hurting themselves. And Du Bois explains this by this concept of the psychological wages of whiteness. Just being white gives you a kind of priceless dignity. And that's what the fascist politician does. The fascist politician makes this empty promise. They say, you have a special dignity that non-whites simply cannot have. And that dignity comes from being just from being white, and equality threatens that dignity. So equality will make you lose the psychological wages of whiteness. So not only does Du Bois there give us a lot of the tools we need to understand why people throw their own interests under the bus, their own material interests under the bus, he gives us a lot of the tools to understand fascism.
Jason Stanley, I want to quote from your book. Again, the book's called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And this is in your introduction. You say this, quote, in the cases of Nazi Germany, Rwanda, contemporary Myanmar, and the victims of ethnic cleansing were subjected to vicious rhetorical attacks by leaders in the press for months or years before the regime turned genocidal. Tell me more about that dynamic. The rhetoric was there before the governments actually acted.
So you find right now people saying, well, look, we're not encountering any genocide yet or mass violence. And that's not quite true, because as we see in the case of our criminal justice system, when we've been talking about super predators and thugs, which has fueled mass violence, mass state violence against black Americans. We have this recent history. But Trump's rhetoric very recently has not led people out onto the streets to attack immigrants. There's been a slight uptick in hate crimes, but it hasn't. 2 years after the campaign, we find dehumanizing attitudes increasing, but it's not like we're seeing large-scale mass violence against immigrants in the streets of the United States. But if you look at other countries, if you look at, say, what happened in Myanmar, it was actually 5 years from the time that mass violence started to when the ethnic cleansing began. In Germany, it was 6 years, it was 5 to 6 years between Hitler's rise and election and seizure of power and Kristallnacht. So it takes a certain amount of time for the rhetoric to engender a kind of attitude that allows people to tolerate and participate in mass violence. Rwanda, I think it's 1990, 1991, when you first start to find the extreme rhetoric of cockroaches and rats. And so there appears in countries to be a period of several years where people get used to thinking of the targeted groups as being appropriate objects of mass violence. And right now we're seeing incredibly harsh rhetoric in the United States of the sort that we found in Rwanda before the genocide, of the sort that you find in the 1930s against German Jews, against Jews, directed against immigrant groups. And people are saying, well, it's just talk. And the fear is that if you read the literature, like Victor Klemperer's Language of the Third Reich, for many years people said it was just talk. So it takes a certain amount of time and there's a preparatory phase, and it appears to take several years before people are tolerant of mass violence. You might look at the family separations as what Fintan O'Toole, the journalist, calls a trial balloon. It's seeing how Americans will deal with the complete brutalization of a group that is represented as hateful.
The normalization of it.
The normalization of it. That's right.
And you also write that fascist politics does not necessarily lead to an explicitly fascist state, but it is dangerous nonetheless. So you can have fascist politics without having a fascist state.
That's right. Right now, I don't think anyone could say that we have a fascist state. And fascist states differ wildly from each other. So it's not my book is not a generalization. It's about fascist states. It's not a book about what a fascist state is. It's about fascist rhetoric and fascist ideology. There are certain tactics, I identify 10 tactics, that are used to seize power, to divide populations against each other, and to create a fanatical group of loyal supporters. And these, the particular tactics I focus on, I call fascist tactics because they're based on ethnic identity and ultranationalism, patriarchy, and the different things I talk about in the book. So these are mechanisms to seize power, and they could result in, they have resulted historically in very different outcomes. I mean, Orban is not now doing mass killings or genocide. You don't find that in other countries that are susceptible right now to fascist politics. Nevertheless, fascist politics is in and of itself dangerous. In the first instance, it dehumanizes segments of the population. Fascism always requires a target. It requires an outgroup that is impure, that are rape threats, that are criminals, that are lawless, against which the people, us, need to be protected. So it always lays the groundwork for mass violence against that group. And given our own history of mass incarceration and present of mass incarceration and harsh rhetoric against Black Americans, we're especially prone to that. And now we're seeing that directed against immigrants, against the media, against liberals, against cultural Marxists, feminists. So it has this dehumanizing element. And the second thing, as I argue in my book, is there's a temptation for politicians to make the rhetoric into reality. So the president, when he ran, claimed that there was an epidemic of violence sweeping through the, quote, inner cities, unquote. Now, this was wildly in contrast to reality. I mean, there's been a slight uptick in violence, but we're still at historically low crime rates. So what happens, but it's going to be conducive to such politics to create crime, because the more crime there is, the more panic you can run on the next election. And so, you know, it's going to be like, this is what, you know, Hitler talked about this when he said, people doubt that the Jews are lazy and diseased. Well, we're going to send millions of Jews across borders, diseased, hungry, in need of support, and then they'll see what we mean. So there's this tendency to make the rhetoric true. And that's a danger over and above the dehumanization.
Jason Stanley is our guest. He is the Jacob Borowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. He's the author of the book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason Stanley, that's really interesting to think about, because I guess when we think of fascism, we think of Nazi Germany. We think of World War II. We also obviously think of Italy during this period of time. We think of the Holocaust and major, huge global events. And maybe we have this expectation for to think about fascism, for fascism to exist. You have to have that kind of major global event. But that's not so.
No, that's not. I mean, well, my focus is on fascist politics. And to have fascist politics be successful, what you need to do is destroy your democratic ethos. You need to destroy the ethos that makes people want to live in a multi-ethnic state. You need to destroy the ethos that makes people feel loyalty towards a multi-party democracy. Arendt talks about the the dangers of the sentiment of party over parties. When people start thinking, well, I don't care about a multi-party democracy. I just want my party to rule all the levers, have all the levers of power. So when people start to lose the democratic ethos, when they start to lose their grip on reality and replace it with power and loyalty, then you need to worry. Because a liberal democratic ethos takes a long time to create. It took us in the United States a long time to create an ethos where we had a public culture of anti-racism. And that seems to be very quickly.
Well, you write about the perceived war on corruption or even draining the swamp. This also has. And, you know, corruption, obviously, and stopping corruption is an important thing. But you write fascists use corruption and a war on corruption, anti-corruption campaigns for their own ends.
When fascist politics takes hold, things mean their opposite. The news becomes the fake news. The news becomes the Lügenpresse, and anti-corruption means corruption. Corruption doesn't mean what it ordinarily does. What I discovered, and I was very surprised by this, is that all fascist campaigns are anti-corruption campaigns. The Ku Klux Klan achieved power in the 1920s by running against corruption. Look at Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin constantly runs anti-corruption campaigns. By some accounts, he's the richest man in the world, enriching himself off of state treasures. I discovered it in the literature on National Socialism, that the National Socialists ran anti-corruption campaigns, but yet stole and looted Jewish property, art, and lives. So Du Bois, as I talk about in the book, I mean, we've already discovered this in Black Reconstruction. Reconstruction was supposed to have ended because of corruption. And Du Bois said, what does corruption there mean? What corruption there means is that it was corrupt that Black Americans were allowed to vote at all. So corruption for the fascist means that a corruption of the traditional order. As I said earlier in the interview, fascism weaponizes the emotion, the feeling of purity. So corruption means impurity. So when the fascist runs an fascist politician runs an anti-corruption campaign, they're running what they're saying is that the traditional order has been subverted. People who are not members of the chosen nation have too much power, are allowed in positions of power. As Kate Mann argues in her book Down Girl, we saw this dialectic unfold in the 2016 election when Donald Trump, of all people, was able to run an anti-corruption campaign against Hillary Clinton. And as Kate Mann rightly says, what happened was he was representing women ruling as president as a corruption of the traditional order.
Jason Stanley is the Jacob Borowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. And he is the author of the book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason Stanley, I found this very interesting, and I thank you greatly for joining us.
Thank you so much, Mitch. Terrific conversation.
And you're listening to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and I hope you found our conversation today with Joseph Stanley valuable. I found it important because I learned that fascism isn't just about whether you have a fascist state or a fascist political party, but that fascism is also a political tactic. And some will disagree, but I actually don't believe we live in a real fascist state, not yet anyways, but we are definitely witnessing fascist politics at the very highest level of the state. And that's a dangerous thing because I think it's easy to think that this spectacle will all be over in a couple of years or so. But we don't know that for sure. And it can be so dangerous that perhaps we should be acting like it won't in order to ensure it's not over in just a couple of years or so. I remember having historian Gerald Horn on this radio program several months ago, and he telling me that for a country that was founded on genocide and slavery, well, we shouldn't be so shocked to see the country then drift towards fascism. And that stuck with me. I always found that interesting.
Friends, we are in our fall 2018 fund drive. And for the radio station where I am broadcasting from, KPFA in Berkeley, and KFCF, our sister station in Fresno, today is the last day that Letters in Politics will be asking you for your financial support of this radio program and of your radio station. For Los Angeles, KPFK, which we're also on live, is wrapping up the first week of its fund drive, so we'll be back at it again next week. But today is the final day for this radio program, both on KPFA and KFCF in Fresno. And a quick note to my friends in Northern California and the Central Valley. This is going to be my last opportunity to try to raise our daily average to $3,000. That will allow me and gives me the ability to justify to bring this radio program that I hope you tune into largely intact for the next fund drive. And for that to happen, in order for me to be able to raise my daily average, I'm going to have to raise this hour $4,500 to make up the difference. And of course, I want to do this the right way. And I feel the right way is to ask you to donate what you can, what's reasonable for you, what you're going to feel good about, and what is according to your own means. $25 is going to make you a member to your radio station. If you can pledge $50, that gets us $50 closer to where we need to go. If you can afford $150, $500, $1,000, again, the way I want to do this is that people who can afford to donate a little bit of money right now to do so according to their own means, and I think we make it. We do need to average about $100 per pledge if we are going to make our goal today. We also do have thank you gifts. The book that we've been in conversation with Jason Stanley, is yours for a thank you gift to you for a pledge of $100. Also, this fund drive, we've had the Letters in Politics American History Pack. This is on an MP3 CD that allows us to put about 10 hours worth of audio on it. And through it, you get all of our most recent interviews concerning American history, from the one we had today, which I think is very much about American fascism and how fascism works here, to the violence in Congress, the caning of Charles Sumner, the abolitionist in 1856, and just sort of what the political dynamics were in the decade leading into the Civil War. Our other show about the 1850s, Kansas Bleeding and John Brown, also the abolitionist. That was a show that people, I think I got a number of emails about that one. That's a part of this collection. Our conversation that we had yesterday on the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution and how that plays into so, and how so many battles are actually over that. A conversation we had some time ago, but recently, like last couple months, on the history of American slavery. When I say American, I mean as a continental, and how slavery throughout the Americas is what actually connected slavery to race for the first time. And as I argued the other day, we may have defeated slavery, but we did not defeat racism that came after it. And a whole lot more. There are 18 interviews on that CD, about 10 hours worth of material, yours for a pledge of $100. You can get the book, How Fascism Works, and the Letters in Politics American History Pack for the discounted rate of $180. And then finally, we're always offering the Letters in Politics complete history pack collections on a USB drive. All of the history packs that we have put together over these last 9 years, you get on a USB drive, talking about 180 interviews or so, roughly speaking, about 140 hours worth of material, all interviews on history that we have done that we think is important for this period of time. So here's the phone number that you can call to help us today on this final day for KPFA. And also KFCF. That phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 5732. Now that's the phone number for listeners in Northern California and the Central Valley. If you're in Los Angeles and contribute to your very important historic radio station, that phone number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. You can also pledge online in Southern California. It's kpfk.org. And in Northern California, it's kpfa.org. And just quickly here, I want to tell you, we had a couple of very large donations come in earlier in the week. And through those donations, I'm all over the place, my friends, Glenn in San Francisco and Philip in Berkeley are challenging us to raise $2,000 this hour. What that means, it's a challenge that if we can raise that amount of money in the next 17 minutes, they too will put in $2,000, and that will be $4,000, and that will be a really good thing for us to be able to do on this radio program. If we cannot raise that amount of money, we do have to offer these good folks their money back, and in doing that, that would be a gigantic step backwards. Here on our final day, we're trying to get our average where I believe it should be. We need to justify our ability to do this program, 10 a.m., Monday through Thursday, and we need to be able to carry our weight. And so I'm hoping you'll help me make it happen. So again, the phone number in Northern California and the Central Valley for KPFA and KFCF, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. And in Southern California, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. Pledge online, kpfa.org or kpfk.org. Joining me on the telephone is, or I think on the telephone, if, or however, however, maybe even telepathically. No, it's not the telephone. Alan Minsky.
It's a little clearer than that.
Alan Minsky.
How you doing, Mitch?
Good morning. Of course, Alan Minsky is the program director down at KPFK in Los Angeles.
So we have these great collections. We have the discount rate of getting How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, plus the American History Pack of interviews. And I have one question for you, Mitch. For $180, you can pick up the Letters in Politics Mondo Pack, which I'm going to talk about in a second. And if you get that combined with How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, is that just 180 plus 100? Is that correct?
No, you're very right to bring it up. Sometimes I worry I have too much in front of me, so I left that one out. But you can get the combo pack of the USB jump drive with all of our historic interviews over the years, along with the book How Fascism Works, together at the discounted rate of $250.
And I want to just recommend that for this day, because How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them by Jason Stanley is a hugely, hugely important work. I do agree with Mitch that we are not currently living in a full regalia fascist state. You do sometimes hear people say that. For instance, the radio stations KPFA and KPFK, while they are where they desperately need your support to keep these great projects going, as of yet, jackbooted fascists, we don't anticipate that they will be kicking in the doors of these radio stations, as they certainly would have done in Mussolini's Italy or Hitler's Germany. But this is a very, very poignant book, because it talks about how fascist tactics are instrumental right now to the contemporary rise of the right and the development that we could see an emergent fascism across democracies in the world, and democracies could collapse. In fact, on this Sunday, in the Brazilian elections, the person who's favored to finish first, though still have to face a runoff, is somebody who is even closer to the classical fascist than Donald Trump, and in fact probably closer to the classical fascist even more than the people in Europe who say they are directly fascist. He has said that he will not respect the result of him losing the elections and is a supporter of the Brazilian military coup that led to 20 years of military rule in Brazil from 64 to the mid-80s. But alas, the How Fascism Works book, $100 pledge. The Letters in Politics Mondo Pack, $180. And I just want to remind people what a fantastic compliment that huge package is to this book and to this question. Because in that package, you not only will get Jason Stanley's interview, you'll also have, what was the name of the author who did the history of Antifa? That was a fantastic interview.
Mark Bray.
That Mitch did.
Mark Bray.
And that will be... and that will be in there. But listen to all of these. Robert Paxson on the history of fascism. Adam Hochschild on the Spanish Civil War. And for those people who don't remember, that was a battle between fascists and anti-fascists. David Kurtzer on the Pope and fascism. Yanis Varoufakis on the rise of the European right. You also have Richard Perotsky on Father Charles Coughlin, Hitler's sympathetic populist voice during the World War II era in the United States. You have Pippa Norris on populist authoritarianism. Peter Ross Range on the rise of Hitler, and many more relevant interviews that Mitch has done. Among those 180 interviews on the $180 USB memory stick, beautifully curated material, clear as day when you open it up as to find which interview where, and it is a $180 pledge. Now, that's about $1 per interview, and they are absolutely just fantastic interviews covering the whole range and scope of human history by the experts in each of the fields. It's an amazing collection. It's an amazing body of work that Mitch and the Letters in Politics team have built up over the years. And you can get it for $180 by itself or for $250 with this very important book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, which I'll talk about again a little bit more. It's a great new book by Jason Stanley. And $250 pledge will get you both of those, $180 for the USB port by itself, $100 for the book by itself. Call in Southern California, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, Northern California, 800-439-5732, which is the same as 800-439-KPFA. Call now, pledge support. And what you are doing when you are pledging support, let's not lose this essential point. You are helping to maintain the only radio project, Pacifica Radio, that is going to generate shows like Letters in Politics that are going to bring this very serious and earnest exploration of human history so that we can understand the present. This is the only station that's going to do this, and Letters in Politics is just the exemplary show within the entirety of American media producing this kind of content. You have this marvelous collection that in itself is absolutely worth every second of audio that's on there in terms of basically achieving like a graduate degree level of understanding of human history. It's absolutely priceless material. And most importantly, even more important than the incredible work that's been done, is the idea that you will be funding a radio station that will continue to do this type of project, and this is available in no other place. So if you think about a $180 pledge, a year-long membership, it's 50 cents a day. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK in Southern California, and up in Northern California and in the Central Valley, 800-439-5732. And let's have a big show for Letters in Politics up in Northern California on the last day that Mitch will be coming to you asking for your support in this fall fund drive in Northern California.
It is the last day that this radio program will be asking for a financial contribution, both on KPFA in Northern California and also in the Central Valley on KFCF and for KPFA.org listeners. So it's really the last day that we are going to have an opportunity to try to raise our average that allows us to do fundraising shows like this. My goal during a fundraising show is to bring something that I think is, that I hope is educational, that I hope is interesting, that I hope is valuable of your time, worth spending a little bit of time with us. And I've always hoped that in return, you may throw a little change, and that could be a lot of change depending on how deep your means are, to help us keep this radio program going. We have a $2,000 challenge this hour, and right now we have raised $475 towards that $2,000 challenge. Again, if we can get to that $2,000 $4,000. It will be $4,000 for us, and we stand a very good chance of getting that daily average up. And that's what we need to do, because we got folks here who are managing this fund drive, and, you know, it's a tough job. They got to make sure, how do I keep this public broadcaster operating and funded and keep the lights on and the radio transmitter going? How do we do this and still at the same time bring broadcasts like the live coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing? I know here in KPFA, we plan on doing a live broadcast potentially tomorrow as the Senate moves to debate and vote on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. We've taken some hits in trying to do this because we thought this is important. This is what people are plugged into. So what we need to do is be able to utilize these moments right now to raise the money to keep this radio station on the air. So we are $475. No, we are now $675 towards that $2,000 challenge. But my friends, we just have four callers calling in to support KPFA and KFCF right now. I need to have a big ending here at the end if we're going to make this. So the phone number in Northern California for KPFA and also for KFCF in the Central Valley is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And for our friends in Southern California, it's 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. Of course, you could pledge for the station that you listen to online at either kpfa.org or kpfk.org. This is it. 6 minutes to go, Alan. We have just four callers calling in right now. We are now, I can say this, though, we are now $825 towards that $2,000 challenge that's on the table right now. It's an opportunity for you to double your donation to KPFA or KPFK, whichever you're calling into. It is also, again, at least for Northern California, I know KPFK will be at it again next week, and I'll join Alan next week in Los Angeles for this. But right now, this is the last time you'll be able to support in Northern California this radio program. And it is this radio station, KPFA, that makes this program possible. It's where I broadcast from. It's who I work for. So give us a call, 1-800-439-5732 in Northern California. 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org and support KPFK in Southern California at 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735 and online at kpfk.org.
And I highly recommend, by the way, that people do pick up Jason Stanley's very important book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. I, by the way, want to thank Janice Vlierick, sorry if I mispronounced that, Janice Vlierick, Sari Sirland, Gary Stewart, Mark Simon, and Jet Springer, and four anonymous donations that have come in this hour. So we are still halfway only to the matching pledge, folks. Call in Northern California, 800-439-5732. And down in Southern California, 818-985-5735. And Jason Stanley, in his book, talks about the 10 pillars of fascism. Alarmed by the pervasive rise of fascist tactics, both at home and around the globe, Stanley focuses here on the structures that unite them. And he says in the epilogue, the mechanism of fascist politics all build on and support one another. They weave a myth of the distinction between us and them based in a romanticized fictional past featuring us and know them and supported by a resentment for a corrupt liberal elite who take our hard-earned money and threaten our traditions. Think of what we heard during the Kavanaugh hearings from the GOP and think about what he's talking about, fascist tactics and the rise of the American right. And those 10 pillars are the mythic past, propaganda, anti-intellectual, unreality. That's number four. Think of fake news here with Trump. Five, hierarchy, victimhood, law and order, eight, sexual anxiety, nine, Sodom and Gomorrah, and 10, Arbeit macht frei, work makes you free. And think about the Kavanaugh hearings. Think about the relevance of this book. Understand what we're facing here in the United States with a rise of a very, very dangerous right wing. This is a book called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And the perfect complement to this book is the Letters in Politics American History Pack for $100. The book is $100. You can get it with the American History Pack for $175. Or even better, the $100 for the book, plus the Letters and Politics Mondo Pack, of which the History Pack is a subset. That's $180 by itself, but together with the book, discounted rate of $250, that will help us get towards the matching pledge, help us reach our goals this hour. Mitch Jezerich, this is a great interview you did with Jason Stanley, and that will be included in either of those packs. So 818-985-5735 in Southern California, or 800-439-5732 in Northern California. And again, I was born in Alta Bates Hospital in Berkeley, California, and those of you up in Northern California, please support Letters in Politics and KPFA. This is just a phenomenal, phenomenal show and station, really the jewel of American media, the station that began community public radio here in the United States. 818-985-5735 in Southern California, and up north, 800-439-5732.
Ellen, we have 1 minute and 45 seconds to go to try to make this $2,000 challenge. We are now at $1,600 towards that $2,000 challenge, which will be good for us, but we even have to go a little bit over if we're going to get to that $4,500 mark to be able to raise our daily average. So, friends, there are three people calling in for KPFA right now, and that's on here on our last day. We're, you know, it may be a sign that there's just not the support out there for a show like this. You know, and Alan, you and I were talking not too long ago. My strategy with this show is we were lamenting about the History Channel on cable. And like I said, if you have good humor about it, maybe some drugs, Ancient Aliens can be fun. But oftentimes I find myself like, oh, God, I want something really more substantive. So I oftentimes have approached this kind of program thinking about, well, what do I want to see, whether it be on that or even PBS stations or whatever it is. It doesn't even matter what it is. What would I want to see? And it always reminds me of what Rebecca Solnit once said, is write the book that you want to read that doesn't exist. And that's what we try to do with this radio program. Friends, 30 seconds to go. Four callers calling in right now. We can use a couple of more. Here's the phone number for Northern California, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org, and for Southern California, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Jeremy Corbyn with Yanis Varoufakis, one of two. Rescuing Democracy by Reviving Socialism. A conversation at the Edinburgh Book Festival, August 20, 2018. Once a year, a tented village goes up in the heart of Edinburgh. The book festival welcomes around 1,000 authors in over 900 events for adults and children. They meet novelists, poets, scientists, philosophers, and activists. The best attended events of 2018 were political panels on how to curb the power of corporations and banks. and the parallel fights for public education and health, and the resistance against privatization across Europe and the Americas. Yanis Varoufakis is a Greek economist, academic, and politician. He was a Syriza member of the Hellenic Parliament and served as the Greek Minister of Finance from January to July 2015. He resigned in protest over the imposition of structural adjustment and bailout loans on the Greek people. Varoufakis has since appeared in numerous debates, lectures, and interviews. In 2016, he co-founded DiEM25, Democracy in Europe Movement 2025, and subsequently backed a Remain in the European Union vote in the UK's Brexit referendum of 2016. Jeremy Corbyn is a leader of the British Labour Party and of the opposition in Parliament since 2015. He was first elected MP for Islington North in 1983. Jeremy Corbyn identifies as a democratic socialist. He advocates reversing austerity cuts to public services and welfare funding made since 2010. And to reverse the privatization of public utilities and the railways in the UK. An anti-war and anti-nuclear campaigner since his youth, he broadly supports non-interventionism and unilateral nuclear disarmament. Here is Yanis Varoufakis, recorded in August 2018.
Good evening, Edinburgh. Thank you, Edinburgh Book Festival, for this wonderful opportunity. This is the fourth event dedicated to the theme of reviving democracy. And what a way to end it with a theme about reviving socialism with Jeremy Corbyn. You see, ladies and gentlemen, the oligarchy would rather imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. But we must be able to dream of a post-capitalist world as a prerequisite to making a democratic, a properly democratic future possible. To humanize politics, speaking of humanizing politics, Jeremy has already made significant contributions to humanizing British politics. And I shall mention just two before we start the conversation. Firstly, he proved that it is entirely possible, through dignity and a steadfast commitment to sincere politics, to sidestep the systematic character assassination attempts of the systemic media. And secondly, he proved that the youth in this country and in every country are not structurally apolitical or apathetic. All they need is to see politicians that are sincere, and then they get reinvigorated, they return to the political arena, and they reinvigorate politics with momentum, with the Labour Party, and indeed with the last general election, where the Labour Party, against the prognosis of the establishment, had its best results since 1945 because of the young people. So, Jeremy, my appreciation as a non-UK person, representing a people that have been downtrodden, and who have been crushed by the same oligarchy, which is attempting to put the pressure on you even before you get into government. But they are not going to get their way. I have no doubt about that. Even though the pressures must be extreme, we, my wife and I, have experienced them severally. But how are you bearing up? Because a lot of people are asking me to ask you that question.
Well, I'm absolutely fine, actually. So if anyone from the Daily Mail's here, you feel free to report that. Listen, yeah, there are pressures, of course, and there are abusive remarks and so on made in lots of places. But I'll tell you what real pressure is. Real pressure is when you can't feed your children. Real pressure is when you're about to lose your home. Real pressure is when you're working in a hospital, you're understaffed, and you've got to make a choice between who's the greatest emergency of a number of very important cases in front of you. And so political representatives have to absorb a lot of pressure, but you've got to recognise the real-life pressure that lots of people are under day in, day out, in a system that is grotesquely unfair, in a society that is deeply divided between the very richest and the very poorest. And surely our message has to be, we cannot afford all these levels of inequality in Britain. We've got to do something about it. And that's the message that we've tried to put, and I put in the general election.
You just reminded me of similar situations in Greece. I was being asked, how can you bear being the finance minister of a bankrupt country? Britain is not Greece. No. And that is a good thing for you and for the Labour Party. Because you have a chance to win the government. And with the fact, given that you still have a central bank and you have a degree of independence and autonomy, a degree. Yeah. No one is autonomous in globalized, financialized capitalism. But you have an opportunity to do things that we couldn't do. But shall we talk about socialism?
Yes.
Because
it's a very good idea.
If Bernie Sanders can turn the good people of Wisconsin into socialists and win the primary election in Wisconsin, I think that we have a duty to return to the scene of our collective left-wing crime that has led socialism to become an impolite word. We need to revive it.
It is about presenting things in a human way and with a human value. It's not about economic and political management. It's about what you're trying to achieve. And that is something that involves and excites people. And it's about unleashing that sense of involvement and creativity that's there in all of us. You mentioned about young people and their non-involvement in politics in Britain. True. And in the elections before 2017, the participation of those younger people who had registered to vote was less than 50%, whereas the turnout for the rest of the population was a lot higher than that. And what happened in 2017 was a lot of young people registered to vote for the first time and indeed voted for the first time because they saw in the policies we were putting forward some sense of hope for themselves. Because they had been told, ever since austerity, indeed before that, because the neocon agenda began in the 70s, it wasn't a recent thing, they'd been told that they should expect to be worse off than their parents and their children should expect to be worse off than them, that they would have less healthcare, less pensions, and they'd have to pay for their education. And what we're saying, that education should be a right, not a privilege, not a commodity, that health should be a right, not a privilege, not a commodity, and that everyone in society matters. And so that means looking quite strongly at the education system, which has become, in my view, over-competitive. In the case of the English education system, obsessed with league tables and tick box results, which puts incredible pressure on students and on teachers, and also results in quite a lot of young people being almost failed by the education system and dropping out of academic study of any sort. And so what we're saying is that young people actually matter. Now, it's not just in Britain. Britain isn't unique in that sense. The movement surrounding Bernie Sanders and his campaign in the Democratic primaries in the United States. I mean, who'd have thought that somebody calling themselves a socialist would get within a whisker of winning the Democratic nomination for the presidency. And it'll be the question we'll all be asking ourselves forevermore. Had it been an election between Sanders and Trump, what would the result have been?
Sanders,
I know which one
it.
I want.
Sanders would have won. Okay. 10 years ago, the young were lured by this fantasy, this dangerous illusion that modern technology on its own, you know, Google and Facebook, would create a better society. I find, do you also find the same, that today they realize that these technologies, however wondrous they may be, they are increasingly monopolized by planning systems like Facebook and Google that concentrate financialized capital and in the end turn them into products. At the same time, you have artificial intelligence. And for the first time, young people understand socialism almost instinctively because they can see that the robots that are going to be producing all those gadgets will have absolutely no need for those gadgets. They will not have any interest, any desire in purchasing them or any capacity to purchase them. So this concentration of capital, which is increasing exponentially, means that capitalism is simply going to produce Uberized labor markets and just comprehensive misery for the very many. Do you find this?
To a point, yes. You can't ignore the incredible achievements of the high-tech world. Mm-hmm. You can't ignore it. I mean, somebody let me try on one of these face things you put on, and it puts you into a virtual reality world, and you can travel anywhere you like. And so it was Saturday night, so I thought, well, I go to Rio, I go to South Africa, I go to Mexico, I'll come home again. And it was fun, you know. Oh, wow, that's South Africa. And it was incredibly realistic what you were looking at within this thing. But it was a complete illusion, a total fantasy world. But then the application of this high tech means that we can achieve far more, you can do far more, you can do far more in medicine and everything else. But, and this is the big but, which you're quite right to draw attention to, the effect has actually been to concentrate power and the agenda in the hands of a small number of very, very powerful companies and actually make a small number of people incredibly rich at the expense of the rest. Technology ought to be something that benefits all of us in the spreading of wealth. This technological revolution so far has not. And it is a question about the living standards of people. Right. And what you can achieve with that technology.
But it's also the cultural impact, because Marx talked about alienation of the proletarian, which effectively meant that the worker felt completely alienated from the products of his or her labor. Mm. But now you get alienated from the products of your consumption as well, because, mm-hmm. you know, when two people get together in social media, there's always a corporation somewhere trying to manipulate their behavior in the interests of the corporation. So the technology is fantastic. I can't live without my smartphone. I'm a techie. I'm a science fiction buff. I have to confess to this. I want to live in communism. And for me, the ideal communism is Star Trek. Because you have machines doing all the work and people have philosophical discussions and they explore the universe. But I fear that capitalism is leading us towards the Matrix.
Who grows the but who grows the food?
Nobody. It comes out of replicators.
No, but look, Star Trek...
He hasn't watched Star Trek.
No, I'm just asking the question. That you're sitting in this high-tech, wonderful world. We're watching screens, dot, dot, dot. Everything's happening. Who's growing the tomatoes?
No one.
What do you eat?
They are produced through fantastic technology that can simulate the best organic food ever. It won't be impossible to do.
I ask you that question because you're quite right.
And then you can grow your own food as a hobby. You can have an allotment.
That's a good idea. That's a really good idea. Yeah, I appreciate it.
I want to touch upon something you said before about the culture of measurement in our schools, in our hospitals. You will recall, I lived through that in the early 80s under Thatcher in this country. How that happened? Do you remember how that happened? It was when Keith Joseph and the gurus, the Hayekian gurus of Margaret Thatcher, tried to effectively abdicate from having any responsibility for education, for health, and so on, by simulating a market mechanism and implanting it into institutions that could never be consistent and compatible with markets, like yeah. the prisons, the court system, the NHS, universities. And I remember how the quality of university education in this country just went down the drain the moment things were valued that could be measured and the intangible things that could not. So effectively, what they did, and as a socialist looking at this, it was absurd. They took the Soviet planning system with indicative prices, the Gosplan, and they implanted it into universities. They did not implant it in the private sector. They implanted it in the public sector. So they took the Soviet planning model and put it in our schools and our systems, with the result that now we have universities that look sparkling and fantastic, and they have all sorts of all singing, all dancing things, but the quality of education in this country has gone down the drain. And I can say that because I'm not a British politician, but I'm somebody who actually studied in Britain, in British universities and schools, and taught here, and I just wouldn't send my child
to
a British university anymore.
But this absurd creation of an internal market in Britain, in local government and in health, meant that you had this notional value of X department, Y department, Z department, and so on. And I was, I remember, I was a member of a health authority in the 1980s when this internal market came in. It was utterly absurd, the whole thing. And I said, why on earth are we buying and selling from each other in the same building when they're all employed by the NHS? And of course, I knew the answer to that question perfectly well. The whole idea was that the pharmacy will be run by Virgin in the future. The ambulance will be run by somebody else, and so on and so on.
It was the first stage.
And it was setting up a market in order to privatise. Yeah. And whilst the principle of the National Health Service is certainly there, the degree of privatisation and with it reduction in working conditions and living standards, so you have a national pay bargaining system within the NHS, of course, it's there, but an awful lot of people are not a party to that because they're working for a contractor going into service. Same with local government and other services as well. Which is why our policies are a combination of recreating the principle of a universal public service like the National Health Service, like the Education Service, but it's also about ensuring that there's real opportunities for everybody, hence the offer we put forward on student fees, and the principle that education should be a right, not a privilege, and not a commodity to be bought and sold. So we will set up a National Education Service on the lines of the NHS.
You know what is interesting? Even the gurus of neoliberal economics recognize that the market fails when it comes to education and to health.
Yeah.
So this is a very interesting paradox. It's like having the Pope, who's an atheist, and the cardinals being believers. So, the gurus of conservative, vulgar, neoclassical, neoliberal economics would tell you that Jeremy Corbyn is right, that you cannot really run a proper health or education service on the basis of a simulation of a market. But those who are employed, whose salaries are directly connected with the bodies, or corporate bodies, that will benefit from the privatization, that come up with the theoretical neoliberal exegesis of why privatization is a good thing. So you will have to do battle against them. And they are many and very well paid.
But it also has the effect of diminishing the working conditions and pay of those within the public sector as well, because they're always told you've got to compete against somebody else. East Coast Main Line, which runs from Edinburgh to London, has now collapsed twice in the private sector. Carillion, which was largely reliant on public sector or partly reliant on public sector contracts, collapsed, and people discovered actually there wasn't anything there.
And of course, this is a universal story. Speaking of collapsed infrastructure, think of Genoa, the privatized motorway system in Italy, belonging to one family, that makes 3 billion euros economic rent from it and not servicing the infrastructure, with the result, the deaths that we had a few days ago. Since I spoke about Italy, let's move on to an event in June 2016. You were accused of being sophisticated by the media.
Of being sophisticated?
Yes. They didn't put it in those terms.
That's a new one. But you've heard that before.
You had the official Remain campaign, which was infantilizing the British public with the Project Fear. And you had the official Leave campaign, which was infantilizing the British public with those monstrous claims as to what Brexit would mean for the country. And you had Jeremy Corbyn and some of us who were saying the EU is a cartel of big business. It's a pretty awful set of institutions, but we're better off staying in and fighting to change it from within in association and collaboration with our comrades, progressives across Europe. That's a sophisticated argument. And you were being accused of not being fully behind the bureaucracy of Brussels, of Barnier, of Merkel, of Hollande. Mm. How do you feel being accused of being sophisticated?
It's a low blow. It really is. It's a low blow. But you know, I cope. What we were arguing for was remain and reform. There are very strong social arguments for the EU. Very strong arguments on the Workers' Rights Directive, on Charter of Fundamental Rights, on its connection with the European Court of Human Rights, environmental protections, consumer protections. Absolutely very strong arguments for all of that. And I would never want to walk away from those. There are also criticisms of the EU on its competition policy. I want our mail system to be in public ownership. There is a competition directive, and there's arguments around that. There are arguments around the competition element within some EU policies, which I think have to be challenged. And so what I was saying was, one is remain in the EU, but we would be a force in the EU for reform of it. And that was the whole point I was making in the campaign. I hadn't heard that I was being over-sophisticated, but I'm...
That's what they meant.
I'll reflect on that.
Because, you know, you had people like Nick Clegg and Tony Blair and David Cameron who were just adopting the EU mantra as if it was sacred. Mm. And then you had the Brexiteers who were saying that Satan had created the EU and it was satanic.
Well,
we were in the middle saying, look, it's pretty bad, but we're better off staying in and fighting within it.
But
that's a sophisticated position to have.
Britain is not in the euro, obviously.
Thank goodness
for that. But we saw the way in which the European Central Bank treated yourselves and also the austerity that was imposed on Ireland, on Portugal and Spain.
It's not just austerity. They committed a crime against the Irish people. The head of the Central Bank of Europe put a gun on the Irish Prime Minister's head and demanded that overnight the losses of private investors, mostly from Germany, should be transferred onto the books of the Irish state. And the Irish Prime Minister succumbed. Now, that's you know, robbery. Just daylight robbery. That's what they did.
I actually I challenged the whole Maastricht idea, which established the European Central Bank, because it was a central bank based on price stability, not on living standards, not on rights and sharing. It was entirely on price stability.
It was a purely ideological construction, which nevertheless, besides being ideologically quite putrid, it was technically and financially ridiculously stupid. We created a central bank without a state to be the central bank of 19 governments without a central bank. Go figure. But having said that, now we are on the road to Brexit. Article 50 process. We have a government that is completely in disarray. It's a dog's Brexit process from where I'm standing, which is Athens. What are you going to do? Let's say that Theresa May collapses and you move into 10 Downing Street before March.
We would obviously take over the negotiations. We'd obviously look for a substantial transition period, and our fundamental position would be access to the European market. We would accept the regulatory alignment. We'd indeed go further than it, and I'd go further than the European Union on a lot of trade deals. But we would not be saying, look, hang on a minute, if you don't give us what we want, we're going to go off and do a private deal with Donald Trump, which will be about deregulation. It'll be about the diminishing of working conditions, which is happening in the United States, courtesy of Trump and his administration. And we will not be going into that sort of protectionist trade war that he's going into at the present time. So we'd be seriously negotiating with them. And we recognize that there's always going to have to be a very close relationship with Europe. After all, half our trade is with Europe, and so it's you can't walk away from it.
May I convey to you what our position as the Democracy in Europe movement is on this transition period? Because there's not a single word of what you said that I disagree with. But to tie down a little bit more, our proposal would be that you go for as close an alignment as possible for a five-year period renewable. That would mean something like Norway Plus, which would effectively respect the Leave verdict of the British voters, create a period during which nothing much changes except common agricultural policy and fisheries. And it gives the House of Commons breathing space during which to debate what kind of longer-term arrangements you want, or the people of Britain want, between the European Union and the United Kingdom, without a ticking clock, without the gun on your heads as parliamentarians, as a country.
But in the meantime, we've got the urgency of it, that unless they make some serious moves and serious agreement, then there are a whole lot of jobs all over the UK, mainly in manufacturing industry, that are going to be seriously at risk.
But
unless they do something, then there's an urgent situation. The supply chain disappears.
When you say they, you mean whom?
Tory government.
Oh, the Tory government.
You heard about
the Tory government
yeah.
will never do anything decent. They will bring a terrible deal back from Brussels. They will not have a parliamentary majority. And my fear is that you're going to end up with a no-deal Brexit. That's our fear, I suspect. And you better make sure that you storm Downing Street as quickly as possible to prevent that.
My preference would be that since they clearly are not capable of negotiating this, they resign and we have a general election
so that
we can have that,
no second choice
before the people.
You heard a discussion between the Greek economist, academic and politician Yanis Varoufakis and the British leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn. Varoufakis was a Syriza member of the Hellenic Parliament and served as the Greek Minister of Finance from January to July 2015. He resigned in protest over the imposition of structural adjustment and bailout loans on the Greek people. Jeremy Corbyn identifies as a democratic socialist. He proposes to undo the austerity cuts to public services and welfare funding made since 2010. He also wants to reverse the privatization of British public utilities and railways. Varoufakis and Corbyn were recorded on August 20, 2018 at the Edinburgh Book Festival. Come back for the rest of their debate when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.
To Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
It also has to be true that we see the whole world as sacred. Why would one place be more important than another, that when we lose track of the fact that all of the world should be sacred in that bigger sense, then we're in trouble, because when we start to designate some places as important and sacred and other places as not important, then inevitably we do greater damage to those places we've deemed not sacred.
That's the voice of Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Robert Jensen regarding his latest book, Plain Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully. Stay tuned.
We are live with Dr. Robert Jensen. Thank you so much for joining us.
thinking about the world and the crises that we face are multiple. You know, we face an economic crisis, an ecological crisis, a social and political ramifications of living in the world that is mired with hierarchies. How do we engage in the world in a way that allows us to live more gracefully, recognizing our interconnection with one another?
Well, that's a great struggle that people have always had to deal with who have a critique of the way systems, big systems of power, work in the world. And I think the answer is that we all find a balance between the amount of time, energy we commit to challenging illegitimate authority, challenging systems of power like white supremacy and patriarchy and capitalism, and how much we try to construct at the level of our day-to-day life a sane and decent community where we think about reducing our consumption and treating both, you know, the human and non-human world more gently. And different people will strike that balance in different ways. But I think as long as we hold both of those goals in mind, the need to challenge power and the need to live decent lives, whatever the balance we accomplish can contribute to the possibility of a better world.
In your latest book, Plain Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to Live the Planet Gracefully, you write about your friend Jim Copeland and about the lessons that you learned from him as to how do we navigate this world of, at times what seems to be counteractions, and yet the importance of recognizing our situatedness and our interrelatedness to one another.
Right. Well, Jim Copeland is a name that people won't recognize unless they knew him personally, because he wasn't famous. He didn't write books. But he was a lifelong activist and had to deal with these questions starting in the 1960s through all of the important movements in the last half of the 20th century. And the first thing Jim would say is that the balance he struck in his life was not for everybody. Everybody should figure this out on their own. But he participated in movements. You know, he participated in the civil rights movement in the U.S., the anti-war movements. He dedicated a lot of his life to feminist movements. But he also tried to be part of decent communities on the ground level. He was a lifelong gardener, and he believed the skills that one cultivates in the garden are important. He contributed to community groups that were focused on the arts or on more social and cultural questions, believing that you have to build strong connections to human beings on the ground. And so the book is really an attempt to tell both the story of Jim and the philosophy behind how he made those decisions to help people who are struggling themselves come to their own conclusions about that.
You talk about the connection between our mind and our body, recognizing that we are, you know, above all things, living beings, just like, you know, all the other sentient beings that share the earth with us. How do we then locate the traces of colonization, of imperialism, that demarcate on our bodies the trauma, the terror that we are forced to live with at times?
It's crucial. And of course, in the modern, you know, high technology world, we're increasingly disembodied. Obviously, we still have bodies and still walk in the world. But take the obvious example of the proliferation of screens and how much of our understanding of the world comes through a screen, whether it's the computer or a smartphone or the movie screen or the television screen or the video game. You know, for many people, a real connection to the larger living world is largely mediated through screens. In effect, it's kind of disembodied. Now, I don't believe everybody has to go throw away their computers, but recognizing that even for those of us living fairly privileged lives, this question of the body is very important. How do we stay connected to that larger living world? And my friend Jim, you know, was a big believer that that was crucial to progressive politics. As I said, he connected to the world in a really profound way through gardening. You know, he'd grown up on a farm, and his body and its connection to the dirt was very important to him. Of course, in other situations, these questions of the body are much more distressing when we think about, you know, the violence of patriarchy. And how that's visited upon primarily women's bodies. The struggle to achieve dignity in much of the third world because of the incredible imbalance in the distribution of wealth and power. There, the problems of the body are much more tangible and obvious. But, you know, these are questions that are meaningful for all of us, no matter where we live, in a sense.
I was thinking about the way you write your story is quite touching and very vulnerable, you know, in the way that you allow the reader to see you at your most naked. And I think that there's a certain power in being this open, you know, with your story, with, you know, in the sharing of our stories, because as you point out in your book, most people tend to want to tell their story of how they succeeded, how their power makes them, you know, this unique or, you know, standalone kind of personality. I see the invitation as your reader as one that is a vulnerability, as one that invites me to engage in my own story as well. But I wonder, how do you see that story connecting to other stories?
Thank you for that comment, because that was an important part of the book for me. There are really two things I was trying to emphasize that I think are especially important for people like me who are academics or writers. You know, a lot of us who teach and write for a living, we tell a story, as you point out, that makes us look really good. Like, here are these great ideas we've come to, as if somehow we, you know, have magic gifts that allow us to do this. But in my case, the ideas I've been writing and teaching about for the last 30 years really formed in collaboration with this friend, Jim Coplin. And by writing about that, I was, you know, recognizing that none of us build our ideas alone, that these are all collaborative. In my case, there was a particularly important collaboration with this one person, but Jim would be the first to recognize that his own ideas came in similar fashion through this interaction with other people. So, you know, we don't do it alone is one lesson. And the vulnerability is a reminder that, you know, when we achieve some success in life, and I'm a, you know, professor at a big university, so I'm successful in some sense, it's easy to avoid talking about the ways we are broken and vulnerable and weak and afraid. And I think for people in those positions of authority to do that is especially important. And that was a big part of how I came to understand the world, was by, instead of trying to ignore my own pain and my own vulnerabilities, through this work with Jim Coplin, I was able to open up and see those as a source of not only suffering personally, but a source of insight that, you know, we don't learn about the world only through our brains and this sort of disembodied thinking. We learn about the world through our engagement with it. And inevitably, if we're human, that means not only triumph and success, it means suffering and pain. And so all of this is part of, you know, every human experience. And I was just trying to write honestly about it, recognizing that I have this incredible privilege at this point in my life. I'm older, I'm established, I have the ability to write books. And I wanted to write as honestly as I could. I don't need to write a book in which I'm the hero. I think too often all of us tell stories when we're trying to make ourselves out to be the hero. And, you know, there are real heroes in the world, I suppose, but I don't feel like one of them.
I love that you not only speak about the courage to live and be open and vulnerable in order to be touched by the world and to touch the world at the same time, but you also invite us to embrace, you know, the pain, the suffering as one of our portals, perhaps, to our own greatness. Because you describe how your friend Jim refused to allow people to just skip, you know, the sadness, or when something became so hard, you know, too hard to bear, he would not let you just skip out of it, but rather engage you and invite you to sit with it and to discover what was in it. What were some of the gifts that you discover in those encounters?
Well, I think it's when we, you know, not only allow ourselves to feel sad. My friend Coplin would have said that sadness isn't really enough of a descriptor. He often talked about grief, especially when talking about the state of nature, the larger living world of which we're a part, in which we are slowly and increasingly rapidly destroying. And Jim used to make sure that people were willing in his world to sit with that grief, to engage it, because out of that grief, out of that recognition of just how much damage we've done to the world and to each other, we do come to new insights about how we might change, you know, a deeper moral reckoning. And I don't think you get to that place without the grief. Now, we live in a culture in which there's a lot of people trying to sell us perpetual happiness, you know, whether it's happiness through drugs or happiness through entertainment or whatever it might be. You know, this is a culture that doesn't want us to feel grief for the simple reason that when people are grieving, they don't tend to spend a lot of money. And so in a mass consumption culture, you know, with all this energy and technology around us, there are a lot of easy ways to dodge the grief. And my friend Coplin simply wouldn't allow that in his own life. And to be his friend was to recognize you would have to reckon with that grief to stay in relationship to him. And that was probably the greatest gift he gave me and many other people as well. I had a very close and special relationship with Jim, but Jim had networks of people that over the 79 years of his life he had affected this way. And I think if we were all in a room and said, you know, what was special about Jim Coplin, there'd be a lot of things, but what would bind us would be the honesty with which Jim was able to look reality straight on and feel what comes from that, that sadness, that grief, and also balanced, of course, with joy. Human life is not just grief, it's also joy. And it's kind of a common theme in poetry and the arts that if you deny your capacity to grieve, you will also implicitly be restricting your ability to feel joy. And Jim Coplin really took that to heart and really understood what that meant, I think.
I love your poem. In the book, you quote Wendell Berry and you say, "It is hard to have hope. It is harder as you grow old. For hope must not depend on feeling good. And there is the dream of love, loneliness and absolute midnight. You also have withdrawn belief in the present reality of the future, which surely would surprise us. And hope is harder when it cannot come by prediction any more than by wishing. But stop dithering," I love this, "the young as the old to hope. What will you tell them? Tell them at least what you said to yourself."
Yeah, you can never go wrong quoting Wendell Berry, in a sense. His poetry is very powerful in that way. And what was so important to me about that passage was that often people who recognize, for instance, we face these multiple ecological crises, who have some sense themselves of the depth of the problems, they'll say, well, people can't handle that, as if somehow you can know something and it's appropriate not to speak honestly of it to others. And so that, you know, that idea, say at least what you say to yourself, is very important, to not let the fear of how other people will react keep you from talking honestly about what you know. And again, Jim Coplin was a real model for that. He didn't go around imposing his views on everybody, but when people did engage him in conversation, he always spoke honestly. He told others what he told himself and wasn't afraid to do that.
We live in a world that is constantly presenting us with recipes, you know, recipes for the, you know, the way to grow the economy, the way to become an academic, the way to do research. There's all kinds of templates that we're being offered. And I guess in so many ways, I've been consumed with this idea that we need a vision of a world that is interconnected, that is intergenerative, you know, that is constantly aware of our own presence with each other and the way we presence, you know, those with us. So how do you see us building a movement that is systematically intentional in I guess in the path of justice, in the path of ecological interconnectedness, and gracefully walking upon the earth in a way that allows many generations long after we've gone to be able to thrive and continue to exist and live in this planet?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that focus on interdependence is incredibly crucial. You know, we live in a culture, again, in the contemporary United States especially, but to some degree the developed world more generally, that obsesses about independence. In the U.S., you know, we're constantly talking about liberty and freedom, yet everyone understands at some level that there's no meaningful human life if you are truly disconnected from other people, that we are interdependent by nature. That's the kind of animals we are. And then the next step, of course, is to realize that interdependence is also with the non-human world, and that the modern culture, especially the mass consumption culture of the first world, disconnects us from other people and disconnects us from the larger world. So I guess the answer to the question, how do we do that, is first of all to recognize how the dominant culture tries to keep us from that recognition. And from there, people will have different solutions. For instance, just take a look at the rise of urban gardening in the United States and beyond. A huge explosion in the number of people who want to not only garden, but garden with other people. Community gardens. Okay, well, that's a recognition that we have a connection to the earth, whether we, you know, we're raised that way or not, because our food comes from the earth, most obviously, and that producing food with our own hands is incredibly rewarding, especially when it's done communally. Now, you know, for most of human history, that's the way people did things. Communally, in a sustainable fashion with the larger living world. We didn't have to be taught how to do it. We didn't have to have programs in it, because for most of human history, that was just how we lived. But recent human history, especially the last 10,000 years, especially the last 200 years, have really kept us from, you know, what is our nature in a sense. And so I think a lot of these things you see are people's attempts to get back to what feels right. And what feels right is to be in a loving connection to other people in a way that doesn't demand we destroy the earth. And people will find different ways to do that, whether it's, you know, making sure you get time to get out of the city and spend some time, you know, walking on a trail on the edge of town. Maybe it's an hour a week of getting closer to, you know, the world without a screen in between you and that world is part of this process. And I think that's, in a sense, where the action is politically, trying to foster ways to bring people together like that, and especially together in ways that don't demand we destroy the earth.
I love that you point out that in your book that the sacred is everywhere, you know, and I think that I feel that when we connect with the earth, with everyone and everything, with a sense of sacredness, of, you know, honoring one another, there is but one place, you know, to be, and is one of co-creation, is one of, you know, reciprocity, is one where we are, you know, respectfully engaging with one another. But clearly, in a society that demarcates all our systems of, you know, of, I don't know, call it subsistence, as hierarchical structures where power and privilege cannot be ignored, how do we suspend those, you know, learned ideologies and ways of being to adopt a more sacred path of interconnection?
Maybe that's the big question, but let me go back. Something you said about the sacred got me thinking. You know, the sacred is a concept that's crucial in almost every culture. It can lead us to designate some spaces as particularly important. For instance, a temple, let's say, or in a church, can be seen as sacred space. And by that, we can mean that that's where we go to recharge. That's where we go to reflect. that we recognize a heightened sense of the sacred in that place. But at the same time, it also has to be true that we see the whole world as sacred. Why would one place be more important than another? That when we lose track of the fact that all of the world should be sacred in that bigger sense, then we're in trouble, because when we start to designate some places as important and sacred and other places as not important, then inevitably we do greater damage to those places we've deemed not sacred. You know, there's another line in the book I quote from Wendell Berry that really drives that home for me as part of a larger poem. He says, "There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places." And I think by that, Wendell Berry means we have to understand the whole world is part of this living earth, and it's all sacred in some sense. And it's only places that we humans have chosen to desecrate, to treat with less respect, that become, in a sense, waste, become unimportant. So if we think about it that way, then the toughest, you know, neighborhood in an urban setting that's all concrete and asphalt and broken bottles is every bit as much as sacred as a pristine mountaintop. It's all sacred because it's all part of the ecosphere. It's all part of this incredibly creative life force. And that's a move that's very important, away from thinking about life simply as a property of organisms. You're alive, Sylvia. I'm alive. The plant is alive. In some sense, that's obviously true. But in another sense, a bigger sense, we can think of the whole earth as being alive, that life is a property of the ecosphere. And that leads us to a different attitude, I think, and a different way of treating the earth. We're not as quick to describe some places as important and other places as garbage. Now, you keep going to the practical. How do you actually, you know, achieve that in the world? And again, some of it's about how we think differently, how we talk and come up with new ideas. But I think you're right that it's also about how we build that into our daily lives. Again, let me go back to my friend Jim and this renewed interest in gardening and in so many urban areas. When you garden, even if it's just planting a couple of tomato plants, right, it puts your hands into the soil. It reconnects you in a very foundational way to this larger living world. And I think that's a good example of that. Now, you know, everybody gardening isn't going to change the world because these structures of power are still there. But when we can reconnect to both the earth and to each other through these communal and collaborative practices, I think it builds our resilience to tackle these systems of power, which we should recognize aren't going away anytime soon. You know, the fact that you and I can agree capitalism is destructive, capitalism is incompatible with a sustainable human presence on the planet, doesn't mean capitalism is going away tomorrow. So we need to build the resilience to keep fighting, even though perhaps in our own lifetime we'll never achieve that victory. And the only way I know to do that is to recharge with other people and to recharge with the earth.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. I love your book, Plain Radical. It's just a very touching homage of what is clearly a very dear friend of yours. And I think with loss, we often get so mired in the grief that we lose the gift that life is a cycle, it's part of a cycle, you know, and we're all in that cycle of creating life and generating life. So imparting, what would you encourage our listeners? How would you encourage them to embrace this invitation? Because we are living in very difficult times, but within this hardship, there is an invitation, and, you know, that each and every one of us can take up.
My friend Jim Coplin, who would be very embarrassed by all this conversation about him because he was a very quiet and humble person. I think what he would say is, first of all, start where you live. Look around. Who are your neighbors? What do they need? What can you do with them? You know, in the end, I think if we can't construct decent communities, if we can't be decent to each other, we don't have a lot of hope politically. And so the answer to that question is going to differ depending on who you are and where you live. For Jim, in addition to gardening, it was volunteering at a community arts project. It was, you know, going to the neighborhood cafe and making sure there were fresh flowers from his garden in the vases, because that beauty was important to him. It was about connecting to the people who had coffee in the morning at that cafe. It was all those little things that help create communities that enrich our lives instead of stress us out. And everybody will find different ways to do that. And the message Jim would leave us with is, don't use my life as a model. Don't try to replicate what I've done. Look around you and ask, what do you want to do yourself? And there you'll find the inspiration.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. How can our audience reach you? Find your books. How can they connect with your work?
If you put my name into a search engine, Robert Jensen, the first page that comes up will be my page, and there's an archive of material people can read for free and a list of books, a couple of which are also online for free, as well as an email address and phone number if anybody wants to get in touch.
Thank you again for being with us today.
Always great to be with you, Sylvia. Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.